spanning drama tracing the emergence of modern Britain.
They're telling me to get out, but I don't know anybody in Jamaica.
The final series of Faith, Hope and Glory.
We belong here, and we are not going anywhere.
This Tuesday to Thursday afternoon at 2:15 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Wednesday the 25th of March. This is Today with Nick Robinson in London and Anna Foster in Salford.
Good morning. The headlines this morning. President Trump has insisted Iran is desperate for a deal to end the war and has sent the US what he called a significant gift. But the fighting goes on. There have been further attacks across the region, including on Iran and Israel. The BBC has learned that a hospital in Kent waited 2 days before raising the alert about the meningitis outbreak, with some experts describing the delay as indefensible.
Also in today's programme, in an exclusive interview, the boss of US investment giant BlackRock, Larry Fink, tells us all bets are off when it comes to the Iran war and the future of the global economy.
There's not going to be an outcome that's somewhere in the middle. It's going to either be two extremes. I could see a year from now oil at $40 a barrel, or I could see it above $150 a barrel. And we have two very extreme outcomes.
Can nudge theory really help us wean ourselves off our addiction to sugary drinks? And after the Netherlands banned mobiles, smartwatches and tablets in the classroom in 2024, what can Dutch school children teach their counterparts here about life without social media?
I think you would get used to it, yeah, relatively fast.
Yeah, maybe now we are a little bit more in the moment. In the breaks, nobody's on their phones.
That's then the new normal.
Before all of that, the BBC News is read for us this morning by Caroline Nichols.
President Trump has insisted that Tehran badly wants a deal to end the 4-week conflict. He hinted at a very significant prize given to the US by Iranian negotiators. Reports in the US say it's drawn up a plan for ending the war, but Iran has denied that talks are taking place. From Washington, here's our North America correspondent, David Willis.
Donald Trump told reporters Iran was, in his words, desperate for a deal to end the war. He insisted talks were underway and added cryptically that the US had received an expensive gift from Iran, which he said showed that he was dealing with the right people. Tehran insists there are no such talks and the president is simply seeking to steady nerves on the financial markets. But reports here and in Israel suggest the Trump administration has proposed a 1-month ceasefire during which both sides would consider a 15-point plan to address Iran's missile development. But as President Trump reaches for a diplomatic solution, some have suggested he may simply be buying time with thousands more US troops currently on their way to the region.
Israel and Iran have continued to exchange airstrikes. Tehran has told the UN that ships which aren't hostile will be allowed to pass through the Strait of Hormuz, a key oil route which it's been threatening. From Jerusalem, our correspondent James Waterhouse reports.
Explosions could be heard in Tehran and plumes of smoke were rising over buildings as Israel confirmed it had carried out more airstrikes. It's as the United Nations nuclear watchdog, the IAEA, says it's been informed by the Iranians that another missile has hit the site of the Bushehr nuclear power plant, but that no buildings were damaged. Iran is still returning fire. It claims to have launched missiles at Israel, Jordan, Bahrain, and towards Kuwait, where officials say drones hit an oil tank, causing a fire at its international airport.
The head of the world's biggest asset management company has warned the future of the world economy depends on whether Iran continues to threaten the security of energy and shipping. Larry Fink, who runs the US firm BlackRock, told the BBC that if oil prices reached $150 a barrel, it would trigger a global recession. He was speaking exclusively to the BBC's business editor, Simon Jack.
It's not so much how long it goes on, it's how it ends. Larry Fink suggests that either Iran peacefully reintegrates back into the global economy and oil prices fall back below pre-war levels, or it doesn't, with profound economic consequences.
If there's a cessation of war and yet Iran remains a threat to trade, a threat to the Straits of Hormuz, then I would argue that we could have years of
above $100, closer to $150 oil, we'll have global recession.
Larry Fink also dismissed suggestions that the trillions being poured into AI investment was a bubble. He said AI would replace many white-collar jobs and more people should pursue technical skills rather than go to university.
The BBC has learned that East Kent Hospital's NHS Trust waited 2 days before raising the alarm about the meningitis outbreak, a delay which some experts have called indefensible. Doctors have a legal duty to report cases of the disease to the UK Health Security Agency as soon as they're suspected. Here's our health correspondent, Nick Triggle.
Staff at the Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother Hospital in Margate, were the first to alert the health authorities of a meningitis case in Kent this month. The delay has been criticised, with experts saying it was indefensible not to raise the alarm straight away, saying more prompt action could have meant the outbreak was spotted sooner. There have been 23 confirmed or probable cases so far, with 2 people dying. The hospital acknowledged it had missed an opportunity, explaining it had been waiting for test results to make a diagnosis.
A court in New Mexico has ordered the owner of Instagram, Facebook and WhatsApp to pay $375 million for misleading users about the safety of its platforms for children. Officials in New Mexico say this marks the first time that a state has successfully sued the company Meta about child safety issues. Our North America technology correspondent Lily Jamali reports.
The case stems from a 2023 undercover operation that New Mexico conducted. Investigators posed on social media as a 13-year-old girl. They say the fake profile was inundated with images and targeted solicitations from child abusers. During the trial, prosecutors said documents and testimony showed Meta employees repeatedly warned their bosses about the dangers which the firm's platforms presented to children. Meta has said it respectfully disagrees with the verdict and will appeal, adding it works hard to keep young users safe.
Research suggests public satisfaction with NHS services across England, Scotland and Wales has increased for the first time since the pandemic. It rose last year to 26% from an all-time low of 21% the previous year. The analysis of the British Social Attitude Survey was carried out by 2 health think tanks, the King's Fund and the Nuffield Trust, which welcomed the rise. But they warned that younger people were less happy with the service. The Social Democrats of Denmark's Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen has won the most seats in the country's general election, but the left-wing coalition she led has lost its overall majority in Parliament. Mette Frederiksen called the vote months earlier than expected, buoyed by popular support for her handling of President Trump's threat to annex the autonomous Danish territory of Greenland. Dame Sarah Mullally will be installed as the first female leader of the Church of England in a service at Canterbury Cathedral this afternoon. The congregation will include members of the royal family, as well as nurses, reflecting her career before becoming a cleric.
Thank you very much. 7 minutes past six now. Time to check what the weather has in store for us today with Chris Forkes. Morning, Chris.
Good morning, Anna. And we're looking at a much colder day today, thanks to northwesterly winds dragging in a polar air mass. You'll notice the change for sure. And weather-wise today, it is a day of sunny spells and blustery showers, with a number of those showers coming through as hail, sleet, even a bit of snow in some of the heaviest ones in Scotland. Now, for England and Wales, we are looking at some heavy showers already, particularly for Wales and western areas of England, but it's a day where nowhere is immune from seeing an odd downpour. I think quite a lot of the showers will have hailstorms mixed in. I wouldn't like to say that anywhere would be dry, but across northeast England, that's probably where you're going to see fewest of the showers today. It is a windy day with gusts of around 40 or 50 miles an hour, but 60 miles an hour at the moment around the coast of West Wales. Temperatures, well, we're looking at highs of around 7 to 10 Celsius. Now, for Northern Ireland, there are also going to be frequent showers, one or two of those coming through with sleet and hail in as well. Sunny spells between the downpours, blustery northwesterly winds, and temperatures here around 6 to 8 Celsius. In Scotland, loads of showers as well. Now, a lot of the showers this morning are coming through with sleet. We have seen some snow, not just confined to the mountains, but also in some of the heaviest showers down to pretty low levels. But I think any settling snow is going to be pretty high up in the mountains of Scotland and actually the Cumbrian Fells today, above around 400 metres elevation. So that's something that fell walkers might want to take note of. Temperatures in Scotland around 6 to 8 Celsius, but only 4 today in Lerwick. Overnight, there'll be quite a widespread frost and there'll be some further wintry showers tomorrow for northern and eastern Scotland and eastern coastal counties of England as well. That's the latest.
Chris, thank you very much indeed. 9 minutes past six. Let's take our first look at the morning papers. The Mail says the middle class will foot the bill for the Chancellor's plan to subsidise higher energy costs because of the Iran conflict. It will target those on benefits and lower incomes. The Times believes the warm home discount, which reduces energy bills for poorer households, could be used as a model for the scheme. The Daily Telegraph quotes the head of Shell as saying the European governments could have to curb energy demand within days to stop the Middle East crisis causing fuel shortages.
A number of the papers this morning consider the prospect of talks to end the war in Iran. The Times says President Trump seems to have found someone to his liking to negotiate with. It says Mohammed Braguer Khalibaf is a hard-talking right-winger reported to have made a fortune in property, formerly the mayor of Tehran and now the Speaker of Parliament. The Guardian considers whether he is a strongman or a pragmatic insider and concludes that his anointment, as the paper puts it, by Mr. Trump, may at least send the message to Israel that he is not to be killed.
The Daily Mirror says the six-time Olympic champion cyclist Chris Hoy has launched a new campaign urging men to get themselves tested for prostate cancer after he was diagnosed with an incurable form of the disease. It's easy, it's simple, it's painless, and it could save your life, was the message he delivered at an event in Glasgow, says the paper. The Telegraph reports that prostate cancer screening plans could be scaled back even further despite growing calls for more testing to be rolled out.
Many of the back pages this morning lead with the departure from Liverpool of the Egyptian striker Mo Salah after 9 years. The Daily Express headlines its coverage with a phrase from his statement, "I'll never walk alone." The iPaper says there's confidence in Saudi Arabia that he might join the Pro League there as long as there is a de-escalation of conflict in the region.
Sticking with football, the Express considers the most expensive Three Lions World Cup shirts ever. At £90, the Daily Star suggests the shirt hits the fan.
A beautifully read. There was so much scope for disaster there. You negotiated it perfectly. It is 11 minutes past six now.
Phew. 11. Yeah, it is indeed. US airborne troops have been ordered to head to the Gulf to join thousands of Marines who are already on their way. This news came as President Trump once again declared the war had in fact been won and that regime change had already been secured. I asked our North America correspondent Anthony Zerka to unpack what the president's talking about and to start with the facts rather than the rest. Trick. Who are those troops and what will they be doing?
Well, our media partner CBS News and other media outlets here in the United States are reporting that about 2,000 soldiers from the Army's 82nd Airborne Division are being moved from the U.S. to the Middle East in the coming days. And what they could be the White House says this is just movement of troops. They're not going to comment on it, but it is perceived to give the president greater options in using ground forces against Iran. And you have to remember, this is on top of nearly 5,000 Marines that have been dispatched from California and Japan that are on their way in amphibious assault fleets. So all combined, it gives the president 7,000, 8,000 new ground troops that he could use, perhaps to secure the Strait of Hormuz, perhaps to take Karg Island, which is the oil refinery terminal that is key to Iran's oil export industry. But we don't know exactly what they're going to do. And of course, the White House isn't confirming any plans.
And it comes at a time when the president once again says the war's over and he's already got regime change.
Yeah, that's kind of the dramatic difference here is that on one hand, the trajectory towards peace that Donald Trump started on Monday, talking about negotiations that had begun happening between the United States and Iran, talking about how these negotiations were going well and that progress was being made. It felt like this was a change, certainly a change of attitude and a change of language from Donald Trump. But then on the other hand, we do see this new troop buildup happening. And as we've seen in the past, sometimes what we hear from the administration when it counters from what's happening with military movement, those military forces end up being used. So I think we have to keep an eye on what's happening on the ground in addition to the rhetoric that is coming from Washington, D.C.
Now, part of your role these days, Anthony, is to be an interpreter of Trumpisms. Have you the slightest clue what the president meant when he said he'd had a present from the Iranians and seemed to hint it was in the form of oil or oil shipments?
A very significant prize. Yeah, I don't know what that meant. He didn't give any details, but it's been interpreted as being related to oil and gas or to the Strait of Hormuz, perhaps transit through the strait, perhaps access to Iranian oil and gas. But we don't know otherwise. He was very cryptic on that, and the BBC has asked the White House for more details, and they have yet to be forthcoming on that.
Anthony Zerka in Washington, D.C. Thank you.
It's 14 minutes past six. The NHS waited 2 days before raising the alarm about the meningitis outbreak in Kent, despite there being a legal duty to report cases as soon as they're suspected. Well, our correspondent Greg McKenzie can tell us more. Greg, what has the BBC uncovered on this?
Well, the BBC has learned that the NHS waited 2 days before raising the alarm about the meningitis outbreak. So the UK Health Security Agency was first alerted of a case by the Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother Hospital in Margate on the afternoon of Friday the 13th of March. But that patient had actually arrived into that hospital 2 days earlier. But there was a delay in reporting to health officials, despite there being a legal requirement for cases or even suspected cases of meningitis to be reported immediately. Now, it meant that there was a delay in tracing close contacts of the patient and potentially identifying that there was a wider outbreak. Now, the BBC understands the patient who was admitted into that hospital on Wednesday, the 11th of March in the evening with meningitis symptoms was in fact Annabel McKay, a student at the University of Kent. Now, she first spoke to us last week and has now said that she's surprised that her case was not reported on sooner.
That's interesting. Have we had any response from the NHS yet? Any response from medical professionals, Greg?
Well, yes, the hospital, which is run by East Kent Hospitals NHS Trust, are not able to confirm it was Annabel that was admitted to the hospital as that first patient, but has issued a statement and has admitted to the BBC it had missed an opportunity to alert the UK Health Security Agency sooner. It said that it had waited until there was a formal diagnosis via a confirmed test. Now, Dr. Des Holden, who is the acting chief executive of the East Kent Hospitals NHS Trust, added in a statement that we recognise there was an opportunity prior to diagnosis to notify the UK Health Security Agency sooner. Well, experts have criticised that delay, with one professor saying the delay in alerting the UK Health Security Agency is indefensible.
Greg McKenzie, thank you.
We'll get the chance to put that to the Health Secretary just after 8 o'clock. But now at 17 minutes past six, let's turn to the business news. We keep hearing about rising energy prices. One particular energy price is in our sights this morning. It's the price of jet fuel, because it's more than doubled since the start of the war with Iran, with numerous major airlines raising their prices as a result. One of those is Air Asia. Sean has the chief executive with him.
Tony Fernandez with me, Nick. Yes, so AirAsia Group is the Malaysian budget airline, runs thousands of flights a week, largely in Southeast Asia. It's one of those airlines that doesn't hedge its fuel. So, in other words, it doesn't buy fuel in advance at a fixed cost, unlike a lot of major European carriers who do that. AirAsia also announced in June last year that it would be launching its new Middle East hub in Bahrain, with daily flights connecting Kuala Lumpur with London Gatwick as well. Tony Fernandez, chief executive of Air Asia Group, good morning to you.
Good morning.
What has been?
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for your time. What has been the impact of this war on Air Asia so far?
Well, at the moment, kind of a shell shock, to be honest. You wake up one morning and one of your major costs has doubled. But, you know, we're a very resilient group. We've been through many, many calamities. The most important thing vis-a-vis, I mean, my last major crisis was COVID. was that we can still fly at the moment. Jet fuel supplies are still okay in our part of the world. That means we have an ability to recover quicker. We are taking this opportunity to, because for us, it's not just about raising fares. We're serving a market that wants low fares, and we want to stimulate the market. So we have to be double innovative in this kind of environment. We're furiously cutting costs, using this opportunity to renegotiate with governments and airports so that passengers are not affected by a massive increase. And of course, there has to be some increase in the airfare as well. But we're also pushing very hard on ancillary income, etc. So far, shock to the system, But network is as normal. Load factors are very high at 90%. We've just finished the Eid period, and we are still seeing strong demand.
Are you preparing for a prolonged period of higher jet fuel prices? You've had the shock, but are you now thinking this could be it at these higher levels for a while?
Well, you know, it went as high as $236. I've never seen anything like that. And just on your point on hedging, no airline makes money from hedging. History has shown that. That's why I rather adjust fares and costs when fuel goes up. Now, of course, you know, no one predicted this kind of scenario, so hedging would have been very useful, but I still stand by the principle that hedging generally is not effective. It's better to use your cost base or your fares.
So you're not changing your approach on that, but I just wonder if in other ways you are thinking, you talk about one of the biggest shocks you've seen, you're thinking that this is going to actually change how you're going to have to run your business in the longer run, not just deal with the temperature.
No, I don't think so. Look, we've had a very politics are generally calmer than what we have right now. So I'm not going to make my long-term decisions on leaders who sometimes make very rash decisions. But going back to your question, you know, whether this will be prolonged, I'm not a crystal ball, but I think economics and life is driving people, very headstrong people, to the table. And we're seeing jet fuel has come off its highs of $236. Today it's about $150. So I don't think it will be long,
Are you considering, as some airlines have, you know, we've heard United Airlines talk about, you know, flying less on certain routes, just even overnight, Jetstar New Zealand has scrapped a lot of its regional flights. SAS, since the Scandinavian airline, has done similar.
Yeah.
Are you having to look at some routes now and consider flying less in the coming days?
At the moment, no. But we are taking this opportunity because we've had, you know, we've come out of a COVID shock. We had 300 planes on the ground. We still have, you know, we storage 300 planes. We're still getting planes back into the fleet. So we're taking this opportunity to this is also after Eid, to cut down the network so that we can repair and get our fleet back to full strength. So, you know, we've always looked at crises and see what opportunities we can. This is a wonderful opportunity.
So are you cancelling some flights within that?
Well, they were already pre-planned, to be honest, because after the Muslim New Year and Chinese New Year, there's obviously a smaller demand. So that cancellation is not caused by the war, but caused generally by a slowdown after two huge periods. It picks up again in May.
Your plans for Bahrain, launching a new Middle East hub there, you know, announced sort of well before war began a few weeks ago. But you had expectations to be opening and getting those flights on the road to London Gatwick in June this year. Are you still thinking June this year? We can do that?
Very much, June 26th. I mean, listening to your show and the analysis and people trying to read Donald Trump's mind and whether he's going to deploy soldiers, etc., who knows? The only thing I can say is this is costing the American a lot of money. It's costing the world a lot of money, which also impacts the American economy. So I think a solution needs to be made.
But you do see how your customers will be reacting, and you'll have insight into that. The fact that the Middle East of, you know, whether we talk about Dubai or Doha, Bahrain, many people would have viewed those as either changing points on a long-haul flight, a tourism destination in recent years, not a target in a war in the Middle East. Surely that changes a mentality.
I don't think so. I've been through... People have short memories. Look, while people who may be living there or thinking of moving from the UK to a home in Dubai may have second thoughts while the threat of, some Middle East conflicts are still unresolved, because while they may resolve this, if they don't resolve the real issue, which is Palestine, it can pop up again. So I think that may be impacted. Tourism may be impacted, but I think from an airline transit point, I think Emirates, Qatar will bounce back very strongly. People have short memories. I've been through many, many crises, from from terrorism to tsunamis to earthquakes to bombs, you know, COVID, etc. People have short memories.
If this is prolonged and the price of oil, you know, again, this morning we're saying it's $100 a barrel. If it stays $100 a barrel for an extended period, what are the consequences for the aviation industry?
Well, I think demand will drop. I think that's inevitable. Even at the top end of the market, you know, and the airlines such as Singapore Airlines, etc., who are all saying that, you know, they can absorb it. There's a point where even business class passengers will think twice about paying £15,000 for a fare. So demand will drop.
Well, that was some advice from the International Energy Agency, wasn't it? About, you know, looking at the world reducing its usage, and business class flights and corporate travel is one place where that could go. What do you make of those comments?
Well, I mean, it's reality, but I mean, you know, airlines aren't going to restrict their business because of this. We just have to plow on. But the market will sort itself out.
What is, given you described it as a huge shock, what do you think are the major concerns that you have about the impact of this war in a way it might have changed things for the longer run?
Well, yeah, in my part of the world, nothing, to be absolutely honest. And I don't believe our plans will change for Bahrain because it's a stopover. In terms of a long-term impact, look, and you may say I'm biased and looking at it with a slightly slanted view, but travel is very, very part of our ecosystem, and people love to travel, and COVID showed that. If you remember a few years ago when there was a volcano in Iceland and people couldn't move around Europe, it caused enormous problems. And, you know, as I've been consistent through this interview, I don't think the shots will be long. Travel is almost a way of life, and it will return to normality. Now, how quick it responds to the pricing, we'll have to see. If there's a long-term high oil price, then yes, I think there will be some negative demand.
How much higher would you expect your fares to be, say, this summer, if that was the
case?
Well,
we've looked at about, you know, our fares are low, so in terms of dollar terms, we've managed to cap them at about $15, which is very impressive, to be honest.
And that's percentage-wise?
As a percentage-wise, that would be about 15%.
Tony Fernandez, thank you for your time this morning. Chief Executive of Air Asia Group. Listening to that, Simon French from Panmure Gordon. Simon, so Tony Fernandez thinks it'll all bounce back. Is that necessarily the mood of the wider aviation industry at the moment?
Morning, Sean. I felt there was quite a lot of parallels that Tony was drawing with the COVID experience, and certainly in terms of as an energy price shock for operators, for airlines, that is the case. I think what is perhaps more interesting from a economic standpoint is how much demand will react to conditions in the Middle East, because of course coming out of the COVID pandemic, there was a lot of pent-up demand. Travellers had been frustrated, not able to travel because of restrictions, and they had, not all households, but quite a lot of households had excess savings. That is not the case now, and therefore the degree to which airlines can pass on those cost increases and the customer will accept it, I think, is the big imponderable, and why some of the parallels with the COVID period don't really hold 4 years on.
And we'll be hearing more this morning from Simon Jack, our business editor's interview with Larry Fink, the boss of BlackRock, the world's biggest asset manager. You've heard a good chunk of this already this morning. What jumped out from you about his comments, you know, seeing that the world could go into global recession if oil was $150 a barrel?
I think the comments of quite a bifurcated set of options, i.e. a very low oil price, I think he referenced $40 a barrel, is one scenario where both Iranian and Venezuelan oil comes on stream and the conflict gets resolved quite quickly, versus a very demand destructive outcome of a persistent $150 a barrel of oil outcome. And that is really the scenario which investors have to try and price up at the moment. And interest rate swaps are very, very volatile off the back of that.
Simon French, thank you very much. Simon Jack and his interview with Larry Fink. Plenty more of that, I think, after 8 o'clock this morning.
Yeah, you can hear that later in the programme. Thank you, Sean. It's just coming round to 29 minutes past six. Time for the sport with Mike. Morning.
Morning, Anna. There are some days when it feels like there really is only one story in town, and that is certainly reflected on pretty much all of the back pages and some of the fronts this morning. We, of course, talk of Mohamed Salah leaving Liverpool. Salah days are over, say the Daily Mail on their back page. The Times go with Salah's summer Liverpool exit. Salah to leave Liverpool, say the Telegraph, the Express back page, I'll never walk alone, and what's this one? The Guardian. Time of my life, Salah to leave Liverpool as free agent at the end of the season. This is the news confirmed yesterday evening that after 9 years at the club, Mo Salah has announced he will leave Liverpool at the end of the season. The Egypt international confirmed the news in a video message on his social media accounts yesterday.
Leaving is never easy. You gave me the best time of my life. I will be always one of you. This club will always be my home, to me and to my family.
Music, just a backing track, by the way. That's not Mo Salah on the piano himself. He did help Liverpool to win two Premier League titles, the Champions League, FIFA Club World Cup, UEFA Super Cup, FA Cup and two EFL Cups, as well as the Community Shield. And his tally of 255 goals in 435 appearances has him third in the list of Liverpool's all-time leading scorers behind Ian Rush and Roger Hunt. The 33-year-old is also, reportedly, the second highest wage earner in the Premier League. Here's the former Liverpool defender, Stephen Warnock.
You're talking around about 400 grand a week. It's an awful lot of money to turn away from Mohamed Salah's point of view. I think it's an interesting one from Liverpool's side. If they are willing to allow him to leave on a free transfer when potentially they could have got, what was it? They were talking 100 million last year. Financially for the club, that's a huge loss, but they'll probably look at it and think what they're saving on the wage bill every single week will be enough in itself.
Much more on this story later in the programme. Elsewhere, holders Arsenal are on course to reach the semi-finals of the Women's Champions League. They beat their WSL rivals Chelsea 3-1 in the first leg of their quarter-final last night. Alicia Russo scored Arsenal's third to give them that two-goal lead in the tie, but the England striker insists there'll be no complacency in the second leg next week.
We definitely know two goals, it can change in an instant, so we know it's nowhere near done and we'll have to prepare really well, see where we can work on from this game, because they came out really quickly as well in the first 15-20 minutes, hit the post twice, so yeah, we know that the tie's nowhere near done.
And finally, as you may have seen yesterday, good news for UK snooker fans. The World Championship will remain at the Crucible in Sheffield until 2045, with the venue now set to be redeveloped to add up to 500 additional seats. Here's the 1987 champion, Dennis Taylor.
Everybody that turns professional at football, they want to play at Wembley. And it's the same thing. Everybody that turned pro at snooker, they want to win the World Championship and they want to win it in the Crucible Theatre. And there we are. We're going to have some wonderful champions for many, many years to come in this iconic venue.
And we'll have more on this story as well later in the programme. We'll speak to the boss of World Snooker, Barry Hearn.
Mike, thank you very much.
On BBC iPlayer.
What you see, you can't unsee.
Everything from nightmare fuel.
There's a beast on this island!
We've seen it!
We will have vengeance.
To nightmare remedies.
It's okay, I'm fine!
Don't laugh at me!
What's catch of the day? You are, Alan.
From chilling drama to laugh-out-loud comedy. Why ever you stream, BBC iPlayer.
It's 28 minutes to seven. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson in London and Anna Foster in Salford. And Caroline Nichols has a summary of the news.
President Trump has insisted that Iran badly wants a deal to end the four-week conflict. He hinted at a very significant prize given to the US by Iranian negotiators. Reports in the US say it's drawn up a plan for ending the war, but Tehran has denied that talks are taking place. Israel and Iran have continued to exchange airstrikes. Tehran has told the UN that ships which aren't hostile will be allowed to pass through the Strait of Hormuz, a key oil route which it's been threatening. The head of the world's biggest asset management company has warned the future of the world economy depends on whether Iran continues to threaten the security of energy and shipping. Larry Fink, who runs the US firm BlackRock, told the BBC that if oil prices reached $150 a barrel, it would trigger a global recession. The BBC has learnt that East Kent Hospital's NHS Trust waited 2 days before raising the alarm about a meningitis outbreak, a delay which some experts have called indefensible. Doctors have a legal duty to report cases of the disease to the UK's Health Security Agency as soon as they're suspected. A court in New Mexico has ordered the owner of Instagram, Facebook and WhatsApp to pay $375 million for misleading users about the safety of its platforms for children. Officials in New Mexico say this marks the first time that a US state has successfully sued the company Meta over child safety issues. Meta says it will appeal against the verdict. Research suggests public satisfaction with NHS services across England, Scotland and Wales has increased for the first time since the pandemic. It rose last year to 26% from an all-time low of 21% the previous year. Two health think tanks, the King's Fund and the Nuffield Trust, welcomed the rise but warned that younger people were less happy with the service.
Caroline, thank you very much indeed. It is now 25 minutes, or coming up to 25 minutes to seven. The NHS waited 2 days before raising the alarm about the meningitis outbreak, the BBC's learned. The news comes on a day when a survey shows that public satisfaction with the health service in England is on the up, but from an all-time low. Our health editor, Hugh Pym, joins us. Let's begin with that news about the meningitis outbreak. At the time, questions were asked about delays and the UK Health Security Agency insisted there were no delays. Turned out that there were, but maybe lower down the chain, Hugh.
Yes, this is a story just that's been put out by BBC News. The revelation that one of the hospitals involved in treating cases of meningitis B in Kent amongst students and others who attended a club in Canterbury, East Kent, that there was a case that it knew about and had diagnosed on the Thursday. This is the weekend leading up to the 14th, 15th of March. But the UK Health Security Agency was only informed on the Friday, and there may well have been a gap there of more than 24 hours. And the crucial thing is, with a case like this, is that it is reported very promptly to the UK HSA by the NHS, so that they can get on and put out alerts and warn people. So I think it'll add to the sense of, if people had known a bit earlier, would the spread not been quite as rapid as has taken place. But to be clear, this is not the UK HSA that took things on from the Friday and into the weekend. This is to do with the NHS reporting of the first case and others.
Something we'll get the Health Secretary to respond to after 8 o'clock. Now, he is going to say the NHS is on the road to recovery because, he says, you can see that there's an improvement in public satisfaction in the latest survey. What's it telling us, and how does that compare with the reality on the ground?
Well, the think tanks involved, Nuffield Trust and King's Fund, who've been analysing this set of results. It's a survey that goes right back to 1983, the British Social Attitude, so it's seen as very robust and very consistent. They say its significance that public satisfaction has gone up from 21 to 26%. They say that is positive and that is interesting. First time that's happened since 2019. But to go back before the pandemic, satisfaction was above 60% for quite a few years, as high as 70 in one. So they say it's the reversal of a trend, they think, and it's good news, but there's a long, long way to go. And just to look at some of the constituents, A&E satisfaction, 22%, same with dentistry. GPs was 36%, planned treatment, 37%. Social care remains very low at 14%. So the words being used are a glimmer of hope, but a long, long way to go. And Wes Streeting, the Health Secretary, today welcoming it and also announcing plans to help challenged trusts to move in more support to the worst performing trusts, possibly with the leadership being changed.
Hugh Pym, thank you.
It is 23 minutes to seven. President Trump says talks between the US and Iran are happening, despite Tehran suggesting otherwise. Let's get the view from Israel, which is conducting the war alongside the US. James Waterhouse is in Jerusalem. James, what is the Israeli perspective on those may or may not be happening talks?
We're getting very little, Anna, from the Israeli side on to what extent these talks are or are not taking place. I think if you read between the lines, it's because it doesn't want those talks to take place just yet. We've had a brief update saying it's carried out more strikes on Tehran, where there's been plumes of smoke rising up from buildings, explosions being reported. But I'm just looking at an Iranian military spokesman who has just said, aimed at the US, you've reached a stage where you are negotiating with yourselves. Do not call your defeat an agreement. So once again, we're seeing Tehran slap down these claims from the White House. that it is desperate for talks to take place. We've also heard from the UN nuclear agency saying that the Bushehr nuclear power plant, which sits right on the coast, has been struck again by a drone, although no buildings were damaged. So we're seeing this aerial to-ing and fro-ing. Six people have been reportedly killed in southern Lebanon, suggesting Israel is pushing ahead with its offensive there. And I think this is the current dynamic. And as far as Israel is concerned, it's ploughing on.
Yeah. And the US talking to itself, or talking specifically to the oil markets, because, of course, every pronouncement from President Trump has an impact on the price of a barrel of crude at the moment.
It does. And that is the accusation the Iranians are making as well. I mean, just reading on here, Anna, from the spokesman, he says there will be no news of your investments. This is to America, in the region, and you will not see the former price of energy and oil, referring to its far cheaper price just a few weeks ago. So Iran is holding firm for now. Iran is saying, look, we will let friendly ships pass through the Strait of Hormuz if they cooperate with our officials. And that is reflective of its continued control in the region, despite now the heightening rhetoric from America on peace talks being imminent, but also, you know, the reports that America is having to put more military resources into this. Iran isn't budging.
James, thank you. James Waterhouse there in Jerusalem. We'll speak to our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, after 8 o'clock this morning. If it's giving you a headache trying to work out what is actually happening, well, you're not alone.
It's 20 to 7 now. Larry Fink, the world's man who leads the world's largest asset manager, has told the BBC that if Iran remains a threat and oil prices stay high, it will have profound implications for the world economy. It could mean a global recession. And that means that ministers hoped that this would be the year when the economy and living standards recovered have been upended, as we got a hint of from the statement by the Chancellor yesterday. Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent, now joins us. They must be having to rewrite every plan in every department in Whitehall, Henry.
I mean, they're not there yet, but there's certainly a fear, Nick, that that is what they're going to have to do before long. I mean, you're right to say that the government wanted to focus relentlessly on the cost of living this year. That wasn't just because they heard through focus groups that people were still very concerned about it and that they wanted to show that they shared that concern. It was also because the government was daring to hope that things might begin to turn a corner this year and that they could then take credit for that. Well, it now seems plausible that they will spend much of the year talking about the cost of living, but very much not in the way that they hoped. I mean, I think Rachel Reeves' statement yesterday in the House of Commons was a reflection of how concerned the government is, in the sense that the Chancellor gave this statement, but also in the sense that at various points, including when she was talking about a possible energy bailout for households further down the line when the energy price cap expires at the end of June, she was talking about the general principles she would apply rather than specifics. And that was unavoidably because the government, like pretty much everyone, does not know what situation this conflict is going to be in, and therefore the world economy is going to be in, just in a matter of weeks, let alone a matter of months.
It's clear that she was trying to get ahead of the game, wasn't she? Setting out some principles. But she's going to come under mounting pressure for specifics, won't she? I've just been looking at the reaction of the Irish government that has cut the excise duty on petrol and duty quite dramatically. Other governments, Spain, Portugal, elsewhere, are doing the same. And the pressure will come on Whitehall budgets as well, where, you know, hospitals, for example, we're talking to Wes Streeting later in the programme, will have soaring energy bills.
Yeah, absolutely. And so there's various parts of government which will be touched. And then also questions of, well, you know, if the government is going to have to pay for a package of support, even if it's not an unfunded, untargeted package of the sort that Rachel Reeves derided yesterday, well, then that money is going to have to come from elsewhere. And of course, there's the possibility that also comes from this conflict that the government might have to increase defence spending even faster than it is already planning to. I mean, I think it is worth saying that from what Rachel Reeves said yesterday, and also from conversations I've had with people in government, this package of support, which is likely to come at some point, is likely to be really quite limited. Partly that's just because of the sort of practical limitations on how the government can give support to people, because it needs to be people that they already have income details for, people where they already have an understanding of their household finances. So it may well just be people who already access the benefit system. But then that would, of course, provoke a furious political row too. So look, I think it's safe to say that it's far from the last common statement that Rachel Reeves is going to give about this.
Henry, thank you very much indeed. Well, let's listen now to what the Chancellor had to say when she spoke yesterday in Parliament. Here's our correspondent, Sean Curran.
With no indication of how long the conflict in Iran will last or how it will affect the UK economy, the Chancellor couldn't give MPs many details of who would be helped and how if gas and electricity bills increase later this year. But Rachel Reeves was clear that whatever happened, there would be no repeat of the universal bailout scheme introduced in 2022.
The previous government pushed up borrowing, interest rates, inflation and mortgage costs with an unfunded, untargeted package of support under Liz Truss. That gave the support to the most wealthiest of households.
She said this time round the support would be offered to those who needed it most. The Conservative Shadow Chancellor, Sir Mel Stride, said 4 years ago Sir Keir Starmer had called for a universal bailout. He accused Rachel Reeves of coming to the Commons with the economy in tatters.
On energy, on the cost of living, on jobs, on growth, on public finances, on every measure that matters, this Chancellor has left us weak, weak, weak.
There was a very different tone to the exchanges between the Chancellor and a former occupant of 11 Downing Street, Sir Jeremy Hunt. He wanted Rachel Reeves to take a less partisan approach, but he backed the idea of a targeted scheme to help households with their energy bills.
Although last time we gave support to households and families with her support by increasing borrowing, we cannot react to every single economic shock by further increasing our national debt. So will she confirm that when she comes to the House in her budget with targeted support, it will be fully funded and not funded by increasing yet again our national debt?
Rachel Reeves said Jeremy Hunt had had to choose between offering blanket support or no support.
The Right Honourable Gentleman took the right approach then in ensuring that people's energy bills didn't go through the roof. But a target approach would be more appropriate because the top third of families under the previous approach got more than a third of the benefit. That's not right, it's not sensible, and all it does is drive up inflation, interest rates and taxes in the future.
The Deputy Leader of the Liberal Democrats, Daisy Cooper, wanted the current Chancellor to go further.
Will she commit to halving energy bills over the next decade by reforming pricing structures? And if bills rise to more than £400 a year, as some are warning, will the Chancellor commit to coming back to this House and outlining a broader support package so that all struggling households, or many struggling households, don't face a crippling hit of that scale?
Rachel Reeves wondered if Daisy Cooper wanted a targeted scheme or blanket support, and she defended her approach.
£150 off everyone's energy bills, but then targeted support for those who need it most, because we cannot repeat what happened when Liz Truss was Prime Minister, because a cheque was written then and we are now paying the price with higher interest rates, inflation and taxes than we would otherwise have to have.
The SNP's Dave Dugan complained about the help on offer for people who use heating oil.
13% of constituents in Angus and Perthshire Glens are on oil, 5% in Scotland, 2% in England and 0% in Leeds West and Pudsey. Perhaps that's why she's provided £53 million to support oil users, where that won't even touch the sites.
The MP for Leeds West and Pudsey is Rachel Reeves. She said the money would be allocated based on how much oil was used in different parts of the UK.
So there will be no help for my constituents in Leeds West and Pudsey from the £53 million of heating oil because we don't use it. But there will be support for Scottish constituencies, Northern Irish constituencies and many others as well because it is the right thing to do.
The leader of the Greens at Westminster, Ellie Chowns, said the UK was hooked on fossil fuels and she called for investment in green technologies.
We've got a key problem in the UK because gas is coupled to electricity prices. Decoupling those prices is crucial. Will the Chancellor look at the report last week from Commonwealth that points out that decoupling could be achieved right now and would save households at least £200 each?
Rachel Reeve said de-escalation of the war in Iran was the best way to cut bills for families and businesses.
Sean Curran there reporting on yesterday in Parliament. Well, today in Parliament there will be another battle, but about something rather less significant, but would be leading news if it weren't for this war. The argument about whether there should be a ban on under-16s using social media. Yes, says the House of Lords. No, says the House of Commons, who are backing the government's idea of consulting on how best to address online harms. Well, that isn't enough to satisfy many peers who now want to defy the Commons again, send the idea of a ban back to them, including Baroness Dido Harding, who joins us on the line. Morning to you, Baroness Harding.
Morning, Nick.
Now, you're not entirely convinced of the idea of a ban, are you? But you just want to force the government to think harder, do you?
Yes, I think that the role of the House of Lords at this stage of legislation is usually to say, do you really mean it to the MPs? And I think there's a very strong view in the House of Lords that the consultation being proposed by the government isn't enough. And we're saying, really? Do you really mean that? And I think the general public agree with us that just consulting on doing something to protect our children from the harms of social media is nowhere near enough.
And yet, as I suggested in my first question, you don't actually believe, and there are other campaigners, well-known campaigners like Baroness Kidron, who campaigns against the harms done by social media, who don't think a blanket ban on under-16s use it is really the way forward.
No, I don't. I agree. And I'm on the record in the House of Lords saying this. I think we need to hold the technology companies to account to make their products safe enough for our young people to use them. And the blanket ban, firstly, does nothing to protect 16 to 18 year olds and puts all the pressure on our children and none of the pressure on the tech companies who, if they put their brilliant engineers to work, I am certain could produce social media products that had more of the good and a lot less of the bad.
So just to simplify this, are you saying that you and other peers are trying to put the heat on ministers in order that they put the heat on the tech firms rather than saying to young people and their parents, you sort it out for yourselves?
Yes, I think, Nick, it is actually that simple. The job of the House of Lords is to put pressure on the Commons and the government if we think that they have not really understood what the country cares about. And I think that if you look very recently, the government announced the results of a consultation on AI and copyright. And the result of that consultation was the government's not going to do anything. So I genuinely worry that a consultation is often used, as you know, as well as I do in politics, to kick the can down the road. And that's really all the government is offering at the moment. And I think there is a large majority across Parliament that that's nowhere near good enough. We may not all agree on exactly what the government should do, but we're certain they're not doing enough to protect our under 16 year olds online.
This argument will run and run. Baroness Harding, thank you for joining us.
It is at 7:08. New Mexico has become the first US state to sue the tech giant Meta over child safety. A jury there has ordered the company to pay a multi-million dollar fine. Our North America technology correspondent Lily Jamali told me more about it.
So in this case, a U.S. jury in New Mexico has found that Meta violated their state law by misleading users about how safe its services are for kids. So Meta, which owns Instagram and WhatsApp, they also own Facebook and Threads, they were accused of allowing predators to get access to these underage users. And the claim was that that resulted in abuse, and even worse in some cases, it resulted in abuse and trafficking. So ultimately, this jury ordered the company to pay about $375 million. That's less than what the state was requesting, but still a substantial sum that Meta is going to have to pay.
Meta says it disagrees with the verdict and will appeal. Do you think this, Lily, opens the door to more of this happening in other US states now?
It certainly could. I have to imagine that attorneys general across the United States are seeing this verdict and this judgment of $375 million and certainly considering filing a lawsuit against Meta if they haven't already. Several already have. But there are also a slew of other lawsuits that are waiting in the wings. Currently, there's actually a jury that is deliberating on a social media addiction case that was brought by an individual in Los Angeles. There are several cases like that one. And then here where I am in Northern California this summer, we're expecting what's called a multi-district litigation. So thousands of cases all put into one place from individuals, families, school districts, and states. So there is much more legal action expected in the months to come.
Lily Jamali, our North America technology correspondent. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's 6 minutes to seven now. Let's turn now to that warning I was mentioning to Henry Zeffman by one of the most influential figures in world markets, Larry Fink, the boss of the US financial giant BlackRock. He's been talking to our business editor, Simon Jack, and warning that if Iran remains a threat whenever this conflict ends, and if oil prices then stay high, that will have profound implications for the world economy, which translated, Simon Jack, means profound implications for you and me and everybody listening, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. He basically painted a kind of two alternative scenarios. One is that Iran reintegrates peacefully with its neighbours into the world economy. Their oil comes back online. Venezuela oil comes back online and in fact increases. And in a situation like that, you could see oil prices going below where we were before all of this started, even lower, like $50 or even $40 a barrel. On the other hand, if Iran remains a threat, it continues to be hostile, shipping is under threat, then you're looking at years, he said, of plus $100 a barrel of oil, maybe even to 150. And in that situation, he said, you are going to trigger a global recession. He said, do not think we're going to end up somewhere in the middle. It's one or the other. Now, you can take your pick about which is more probable. You know, that's a different calculation. But saying that it's a very bifurcated thing. It's either this or that. We're not going to end up somewhere like $70 a barrel. And as I say, if it does have that long-term effect, that is very corrosive. If we've seen how pervasive energy costs are, that, he said, would trigger a global recession.
Now, he's no politician, and I assume he didn't give recommendations to Donald Trump about what to do in the war. But this fits in with some in the Gulf who are arguing, and it is alleged that the Saudis behind the scenes are saying, now you've started this, you better finish this war in order to get world trading and the world economy back on its feet. And that means going on as long as you need to.
Yeah, I mean, an elegant solution to this is not something that has presented itself very clearly. And clearly the other Gulf states are massively reliant on those straits for their own income generation. So you are looking at a profound impact on some of those Gulf-rich oil states. And in fact, I was at a group with a group of bankers just last night, and they were saying that things like sovereign wealth funds, which we've become very reliant on, not just in the UK, but around Europe, to put money into things like infrastructure, to fund, you know, property purchases. The Gulf are big investors in the UK economy and elsewhere. They are going to have less money to do that, and that's going to show up in some asset prices. Mm.
Meantime, huge pressure, as we were just hearing, on the Chancellor to respond. Now, she hasn't given a detailed response yet, but as I was putting to Henry Zeffman a few minutes ago, with countries like Ireland saying, right, we're slashing petrol duty, there will be big pressure, not just to protect consumers, but also businesses, won't there?
Yeah, and you've seen a lot of different countries taking different approaches to this. For example, Spain has launched a sort of 5 billion euro VAT cut, which is going to cost them, lowering pump prices by about 30 euros. Portugal and Sweden are also cutting VAT. So this idea of the instant case would be the fuel duty rise, which is supposed to go, the COVID era 5p cut in fuel duty is meant to be phased out starting soon. And she's under intense pressure to do that. And one thing I would point out is that as the wholesale cost of fuel goes up, which is about a third usually of the price at the pump, then the government is collecting quite a bit more VAT on that. Remember, there's 20% put on top of everything else. So you could argue that the penny that's meant to go on to, if you were to cancel that out, it might be revenue neutral because they're getting so much more money in VAT.
There's upside as well as down. Upside for the government.
Yeah, exactly.
Simon, we're going to hear your interview with Larry Fink a bit later in the programme. Thank you for joining us.
Let's check the weather at a couple of minutes to seven with Chris Fawkes.
Hi, Anna. And, well, it's turned a lot colder today. We've got blustery northwesterly winds bringing us a mixture of sunshine and showers, but not all the showers are of rain. We have seen some hill snow. A number of the showers will have sleet and hail in as we go on through the day today. We'll start off with the weather story then across England and Wales, and we've got loads of showers already across western areas. I have seen a bit of snow on the very tops of the Welsh hills, so that's something you might come across if you head up really high. Today, I think there will be lots of showers that have hail mixed in with them, and we've got those gusty northwesterly winds that will continue to make it feel pretty chilly. Gusts of around 40 to 50 miles an hour are blowing those showers across the skies pretty quickly. Now, nowhere's immune from catching a shower, but I think one of the drier areas will be across northeast England, where you're probably not going to see very many frequent showers here. Temperatures today, struggling 7 to 10 Celsius. That is below average for the time of year, feeling chilly in that strong wind. Now, for both Northern Ireland and Scotland, we've also got plenty of showers to come through on that strong northwesterly wind. And again, a lot of the showers will have sleet and hail mixed in. Some of the showers, if you head high enough up, are going to be falling as snow. For example, stretches of the A9 are snow-covered at the moment, so there are one or two tricky travelling conditions to be expected if you go high enough up in the mountains. But I think, for the most part, settling snow is going to be above around 400 metres elevation. You might see a bit of snow at times in some of the heavy showers coming down to low elevations, but it won't settle. Sunny spells between the showers today. Temperatures below average. We're looking at highs for Scotland and Northern Ireland, 6 to 8 Celsius, but just 4 for Shetland. That's latest.
Chris, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster in Salford and Nick Robinson in London.
Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Wednesday, the 25th of March. The headlines this morning: Donald Trump has claimed that Iran is desperate for a deal to end the war and has agreed to dismantle its nuclear weapons program. But Tehran has insisted there are no talks, and further attacks have taken place across the Middle East. The BBC has learned that a hospital trust in Kent waited 2 days before sounding the alarm about the first meningitis case 2 weeks ago, with the delay being described as indefensible. And a court in New Mexico has imposed a $375 million fine on Meta, the firm behind Facebook and Instagram, after it was accused of failing to keep children safe.
Coming up in the next hour, how should families and businesses be protected from soaring energy prices? And would drilling for more North Sea oil and gas really help? The Shadow Chancellor joins us. And...
well, back towards Salah. Curling effort! Oh, what a goal! What a splendid goal from Mo Salah!
Liverpool, we all say goodbye to one of football's greats. The BBC News is read this morning by Caroline Nichols.
President Trump has insisted that Tehran badly wants a deal to end the four-week conflict. He hinted at a very significant prize given to the US by Iranian negotiators. Reports in the US say it's drawn up a plan for ending the war, but Iran has denied that talks are taking place. From Washington, here's our North America correspondent, David Willis.
Donald Trump told reporters Iran was, in his words, desperate for a deal to end the war. He insisted talks were underway and added cryptically that the US had received an expensive gift from Iran, which he said showed that he was dealing with the right people. Who those people are, he again refused to say. Tehran insists there are no such talks, and the president is simply seeking to steady nerves on the financial markets. But reports here and in Israel suggest the Trump administration has proposed a one-month ceasefire, during which both sides would consider a 15-point plan to address Iran's missile development. Mr. Trump again surprised reporters by saying that Iran had already agreed to the United States' principal demand, the dismantling of its nuclear weapons program. Pakistan, a key US ally in the region, is acting as mediator and has offered to host talks between the two nations. But as President Trump reaches for a diplomatic solution, some have suggested he may simply be buying time, with thousands more US troops currently on their way to the region.
Israel and Iran have continued to exchange airstrikes. Tehran has told the UN that ships which aren't hostile will be allowed to pass through the Strait of Hormuz, a key oil route which it's been threatening. From Jerusalem, our correspondent James Waterhouse reports.
Explosions could be heard in Tehran and plumes of smoke were rising over buildings as Israel confirmed it had carried out more airstrikes. It's as the United Nations nuclear watchdog, the IAEA, says it's been informed by the Iranians that another missile has hit the site of the Bushehr nuclear power plant, but that no buildings were damaged. Iran is still returning fire. It claims to have launched missiles at Israel, Jordan, Bahrain, and towards Kuwait, where officials say drones hit an oil tank, causing a fire at its international airport.
The head of the world's biggest asset management company has warned the future of the world economy depends on whether Iran continues to threaten the security of energy and shipping. Larry Fink runs the US firm BlackRock, which manages $14 trillion of savers' money. He told the BBC that if oil prices reached $150 a barrel, it would trigger a global recession. Brent crude is currently trading at just under $100 a barrel. Larry Fink was speaking exclusively to the BBC's business editor, Simon Jack.
It's not so much how long it goes on, it's how it ends. That's how the boss of the world's biggest money manager, BlackRock, views the crisis in the Gulf. Larry Fink suggests that either Iran peacefully reintegrates back into the global economy and oil prices fall back below pre-war levels, or it doesn't, with profound economic consequences.
If there's a cessation of war and yet Iran remains a threat to trade, a threat to the Straits of Hormuz, then I would argue that we could have years of above $100, closer to $150 oil. We'll have global recession.
Larry Fink also dismissed suggestions that the trillions being poured into AI investment was a bubble. In his annual letter to the CEOs of the companies in which BlackRock invests, he said AI would replace many white-collar jobs and more people should pursue technical skills rather than go to university.
The government has insisted that the UK has a diverse and resilient energy supply in response to comments made by the chief executive of Shell, Wael Sawan, that a fuel shortage could affect Europe within weeks. Mr. Sawan told a conference in Texas that there had been a ripple effect because of the war, which had already led to parts of Asia cutting energy consumption. The latest inflation figures have just been published. In the 12 months to February, the rate of inflation, as measured by the Consumer Prices Index, was unchanged at 3% compared with the previous month. The figure relates to the period before the war in the Middle East, which pushed up fuel and energy prices. The BBC has learnt that East Kent Hospital's NHS Trust waited 2 days before raising the alarm about the meningitis outbreak, a delay which some experts have called indefensible. Doctors have a legal duty to report cases of the disease to the UK Health Security Agency as soon as they're suspected. Here's our health correspondent, Nick Triggle.
Staff at the Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother Hospital in Margate were the first to alert the health authorities of a meningitis case in Kent this month. The delay has been criticised, with experts saying it was indefensible not to raise the alarm straight away, saying more prompt action could have meant the outbreak was spotted sooner. There have been 23 confirmed or probable cases so far, with 2 people dying. The hospital acknowledged it had missed an opportunity, explaining it had been waiting for test results to make a diagnosis.
A court in New Mexico has ordered the owner of Instagram, Facebook and WhatsApp to pay $375 million for misleading users about the safety of its platforms for children. Officials in New Mexico say this marks the first time that a US state has successfully sued the company Meta about child safety issues. Our North America technology correspondent Lily Jamali reports.
The case stems from a 2023 undercover operation that New Mexico conducted. Investigators posed on social media as a 13-year-old girl. They say the fake profile was inundated with images and targeted solicitations from child abusers. During the trial, prosecutors said documents and testimony showed Meta employees repeatedly warned their bosses about the dangers which the firm's platforms presented to children. Meta has said it respectfully disagrees with the verdict and will appeal, adding it works hard to keep young users safe.
Research suggests there's been an increase in public satisfaction with the NHS in England, Scotland and Wales for the first time since before the pandemic. The analysis was carried out by 2 health think tanks, the King's Fund and the Nuffield Trust, which welcomed the rise. The government says the NHS in England is on the road to recovery and a new plan would support struggling trusts. Our health editor Hugh Pym reports.
The British Social Attitudes Survey has been running since 1983 and provides a consistent gauge of public opinion. The latest was between August and October last year. It shows that overall satisfaction with the NHS rose to 26% from an all-time low of 21% the previous year. The lowest levels of satisfaction were with A&E and dentistry, both on 22%. While 35% of over 65-year-olds were satisfied with the way the NHS is run, it was just 20% among people under 35.
Dame Sarah Mullally will be installed as the first female leader of the Church of England in a service at Canterbury Cathedral this afternoon. The congregation will include members of the royal family. A patient who persuaded a would-be bomber not to blow up a hospital in Leeds will receive the George Medal for gallantry. Nathan Newby, who's 35, spent several hours talking to Mohammed Farouk to prevent the atrocity. Farouk asked him for a cuddle and eventually told him to phone the police before he changed his mind. Emma Glasby reports.
Nathan Newby was being treated at St James's Hospital in Leeds in 2023 when he saw a man acting suspiciously outside. Mohammed Farouk had a pressure cooker bomb with 10 kilograms of explosives and told Mr Newby about his plot to attack the hospital. Mr Newby spent more than 2 hours persuading him to abandon the plan. Farouk was later jailed for 37 years. Mr Newby's bravery is being recognised today.
Emma Clasby reporting.
Thank you, Caroline. It's 9 minutes past seven. Are talks happening between the US and Iran to try to reach a ceasefire? Well, there have been fresh strikes in Tehran and in Israel overnight. And while Donald Trump insists lines of communication are open, they want to make a deal so badly, he said, senior figures in Iran are less convinced, using Mr. Trump's own phrase to describe that as fake news. And after the killing of most of the regime's leaders in Iran by the US and Israel, who is making those decisions and who holds the power over the war and over any potential peace? I asked Professor Hushang Amirahmadi, who's the founder and president of the American-Iranian Council.
The Islamic Republic is 47 years old. And throughout the 47 years, they trained around 500 people at least that were ministers, you know, representatives, governors, presidents, and so on. Of all of these people, let's say about 100 or 150 are eliminated. And in the military in particular, obviously, there were a group that were very close to Mr. Khamenei and part of his entourage. And these people had become generals and big people, big names. Many of them have been eliminated along with Mr. Khamenei. But what happened after Khamenei and this other killings is that increasingly the second rank, the younger officers, so-called, have come into the scene in the field. And these are the guys who are increasingly in charge. So these are like the colonels as opposed to generals.
And how will those people decide among themselves who has the power now?
Well, actually, the power is in the streets. It really isn't in the hands of anybody in Iran. Khamenei had a vertical power structure. With Khamenei eliminated, that vertical structure largely collapsed into a horizontal structure. And even before that, the forces like the IRGC used to be quite decentralized. For example, Iran has 31 provinces, and each province has its own IRGC. And then these people were together, united, say, at the federal or the central level under the Khamenei and some of these generals. Now that the generals and Khamenei are gone, this decentralized political structure has been expanded, and the power, particularly in the military, has been widely distributed. Each officer in its own territory is in complete charge of what should he or she do. Of course, this is all he. That is to say, if the guy in province of Khuzestan who just got a missile hit to it to its territory by Israel, he would just simply order that a missile be sent to Tel Aviv or a missile be sent to UAE. There isn't a central figure who will go there and coordinate who should be hit the next day.
So do you think then that any of them at this stage will even want to negotiate with the US, because they will be seeing their military strategy, diffused as it is, as you were describing there, they'll be seeing it showing success. Will they want to discuss a ceasefire with the US?
See, yes, that's a very good point. Establishment that has been left from Mr. Khamenei, of course, still is there, except that these people really don't have power in the field. If you heard when Mr. Trump said that Iran is negotiating or sending messages, these guys immediately denied, because these people are very afraid of now these younger revolutionary officers who have taken the field in their hands. Mm-hmm. And indeed, if until yesterday Israel or America was killing these big generals, from now on, I will not be surprised that some of this general or this establishment powers could be eliminated by this second rank revolutionary officers that de facto have taken power in their hands.
Professor, that's absolutely fascinating. Professor, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate your time. Thank you so much. Well, let's talk to Lise Doucette, our chief international correspondent. Lise, it's so difficult to work out at the moment if talks are happening or not happening. But that decentralized structure that Iran has ended up with, given that most of its leaders have been killed now, will make conversations of any kind more difficult than they were before.
Yes, good morning, Annie. It's a very interesting observation by the professor. And what he described is what we've often commented on the program, that this decentralization of the command during the war, described as a mosaic. A lot of those high-level commanders in the field will, of course, be concentrating on the war. And any outreach to the current Iranian regime will, of course, go through Tehran. But his observations also confirm what has been said many times during this war. In launching this war, President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel said they wanted to bring down the regime, to open the way for protesters to take over. And what has happened is that while, yes, significant destruction has been inflicted on Iran's conventional military capabilities, quite a large number of top leaders, clerics and commanders have been assassinated. But what has been left is the hardliners have come to the fore. And this is the same thing in the top security and political institutions in Tehran. So in some senses, it has backfired. But what we do understand is that President Trump talks about talks, negotiations. In some sense, it's a difference in language. From everything we hear from Tehran, from people who are close to these mediation efforts, because there's quite a few countries who are now involved in trying to de-escalate, to open the Strait of Hormuz, is that it's not talks per se, it is messages. Messages are definitely being passed between Washington and Tehran. They're going through the old channels of the foreign ministry, through the top negotiator, Abbas Araghchi, Steve Witkoff, but more and more a new channel. At least they are trying to open it up through one of the people in this new order who has risen closer to the top, the Speaker of the Parliament. You've discussed him on the show, on the program before, who has played a key role with the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, with the police. He's now known to some of the people in countries who want to play a part in the mediation. But one observer described Mohammed Bagher Kabilov to me as the last man standing, someone who is ideologically flexible, but whether or not anyone can reach out and engage in talks now when they're the list of targets that Israel says it wants to kill in Iran is long. It's going to go after more of the leaders. And also, while the war is being prosecuted, it's very difficult for negotiations to take place. But definitely, an opening. There is an opening, but it doesn't seem to be as wide as President Trump is talking about. And Iran's demands will have hardened this time, too, as the American demands have hardened, and so have the Iranians, which will make any negotiating path even more difficult than before.
Yeah, it's easy to forget at a moment like this, Lisa, that there has been a deal in the past.
There was. We were at the last Geneva talks, and it was interesting after the talks ended, the Omanis, who were the main mediators, the foreign minister and the foreign ministry of Iran, immediately came out and said, we have made significant progress. But the U.S. envoy, Steve Witkoff, and President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, said nothing. And it was really curious because usually they do say something. What's your assessment of the talks? What's your verdict? They just went back to Washington. And of course, 2 days later, the war started. But the general view was that although the gaps had not been completely narrowed, that there was a path to a narrow nuclear deal. It wouldn't include ballistic missiles. It wouldn't include Iran support for proxies across the Middle East. But there was a deal that was on the table that could be done. Now these new reports coming out that President Trump has a 15-point plan. And if you look down, it is a shopping list, and it includes many of the elements which had been discussed in Geneva and in talks before, that Iran won't have a nuclear weapon, that Iran will not have this highly enriched uranium that has to be shipped out of the country. But it also adds ballistic missiles, that they must open the Strait of Hormuz. But they also add what Iran wants, some at least of what Iran wants, which is an end to sanctions, allowed to a civilian nuclear program. So some people are asking, well, what was the purpose of this war if you're basically going to go back to where you left off largely? Of course, you're adding to it. So there is a sense in which people are now asking, especially when you hear President Trump saying in some of his comments, there's always been, we've discussed this many times, Anna, the confusion about President Trump. Does he want regime change? Or does he want a change in the regime? In other words, working with new officials rather than the ones who were there before and who have now been assassinated. And in Washington, he seemed to confuse the two. He said, we have achieved regime change because there is a change in regime.
Yeah. And questions about how much any new deal might resemble the Iran nuclear deal of 2015 that President Trump pulled out of. Lise, thank you, as always, for your assessment, for your insight. Lise Doucette, our chief international correspondent.
It is now 7:20. Was there a delay that might have cost lives? That was the question we asked after the meningitis outbreak in Kent, which health officials said was unusually fast to spread. Their answer, you may remember, then was no, there'd been no delay, but it turns out there had been one, at least a delay of NHS officials telling health officials in the UK Health Security Agency that there was a problem. Let's talk about how significant that was to Professor Paul Hunter, who's an expert in communicable diseases, Professor of Medicine at the University of East Anglia in Norwich. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
We know that officials at the Queen Elizabeth, sorry, managers at the Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother Hospital in Margate, were told of a case on Wednesday evening, but they didn't tell health officials until 2 days later. How important is that?
Right. Well, the first thing is that there is a legal obligation to notify cases of meningitis on suspicion, not when they're confirmed. And there is very clear guidance that you have to notify by telephone within 24 hours. And the assumption is that you notify them when you've made the diagnosis, or if it's in the middle of the night, first thing in the morning, by phone. And that is something that is a requirement, you know, and has been a requirement for many years.
And how serious is it if you don't do that?
Right. Well, I think there's a number of issues here. The first is that actually the most important thing when you've got a cluster of cases of meningitis is that people who have been in contact are aware that there is a problem. And the reason for that is that this is a disease that you can deteriorate and get very sick very quickly. You know, hours, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 hours can make the difference between somebody who survives well, and somebody who either dies or survives, but with severe life-changing disabilities. And that's why notification is required urgently.
And the fact it wasn't given in this case, might it have led to people being very ill, dying, and certainly must have led to many hundreds of people having to queue for antibiotics because big events took place on Saturday night, which arguably could have been called off.
Absolutely. I think if you look at the epidemic that we've had so far that was published yesterday, I think the most of the cases who've been ill were infected quite early on in the week. So probably not. But I think the issue is that there is certainly likely to have been people who were ultimately admitted to hospital who didn't realise there was a problem and, say, didn't seek medical attention quickly enough. And that to me is the issue. It's not so much antibiotics and preventing other cases as much as making sure people know they need medical attention really quickly if they develop symptoms, so they don't go on and develop more serious disease.
Understood. Just to be clear, that it's the people who had very close direct contact who had a delay in seeking the help they really needed, rather than an issue of much wider spread because of people going to that nightclub in Canterbury.
I think so, yes, because the days that people became ill meant that they would have all or almost all have caught their infections before any reasonable chance of the outbreak being detected.
Professor Paul Hunter of the University of East Anglia, thank you very much.
It's 24 minutes past seven. We got the latest inflation figures at 7 o'clock. Prices rose by 3% overall in the year to February, according to those. However, Sean, they feel a little like ancient history because they don't take into account the impact of the war in Iran.
They don't. And actually, what they do is serve as a reminder of the trajectory that the prices and the economy might have been on before we saw wholesale oil and gas prices spike in recent weeks. So these latest numbers from the Office for National Statistics actually show that it was falls in petrol prices that actually kept a lid on overall price rises. There was little change in food prices as well. I've got Anna Leach with me, who's chief executive of the Institute of Directors, which supports business leaders right across the UK. Anna, morning to you. Can you give us a bit of an idea of how much the prospects for costs have changed for your members in recent weeks and what these numbers we get this morning sort of show about the jolt?
Well, good morning. Well, of course, they've changed rather dramatically. As you say, you know, within the figures this morning is reference to some declines in petrol and diesel prices that took place in February and helped to keep inflation steady at 3%. Whereas we know that over March so far, we've had price rises of multiples of the declines that were seen in February. So it's a very different inflationary landscape already just for the next month's print, let alone months coming out.
What happens, Anna, when there is such a big change in thinking and approach in a short space of time?
It depends who's doing the thinking, really. For economists, I mean, you just get a huge range of scenarios being run regarding potential directions for inflation and GDP.
For bosses around the country, I'm thinking.
Yeah. Well, for them, of course, I mean, the immediate concern is safety of any of their staff who were in the Middle East at the time the conflict broke out. So it was about getting them back safely. Then it's about operational concerns. Can we get product? Can we continue to operate? Are we reliant on critical minerals or products from that region? And can we still get them? Will people still ship them? Can we even get given a price, let alone any kind of delivery schedule? Are they being shipped in a different route now?
And we had this survey yesterday of bosses that reflected March. So this was from S&P Global. It gave a bit of insight into some of that. Production costs in particular seem to be rocketing.
Yes, that's right. Because it's a war, a lot of force majeure is being impacted in contracts, which means you're no longer bound by contract claims. So you can change your pricing, and companies are seeing that in fuel surcharges in transport costs. So if you're in logistics or haulage, you're having to add on very significant increases to your pricing because the price of your fuel has jumped so significantly and is rising constantly. So you're seeing as well reports in the farming sector with red diesel. It's priced on delivery. You've paid up front. That doesn't mean anything anymore. You'll find out the price when we turn up at your door.
Anna, thank you for your time this morning. Anna Leach, their Chief Executive of the Institute of Directors. So, as you say, Anna Foster, this reflective of, you know, what feels like ancient history. So in a month's time, that is where we really will be closely watching those numbers, what has been that early impact of these oil and gas spikes.
Yeah, and those are the figures we'll look for. Thank you, Sean.
It's time now for the sport at 28 minutes past seven. Here's Mike.
Nick, thank you. Just one story dominates the sport this morning.
Breaking news, Liverpool forward Mohamed Salah is to leave the club at the end of the season.
The Egyptian has released a farewell message on his social media accounts.
I'm so sorry because we've just had some major breaking news. We've just heard that Mohamed Salah has announced that he will be leaving Liverpool at the end of the season.
Hello everyone. Unfortunately, the day has come. This is the first part of my farewell. I will be leaving Liverpool at the end of this season. I never imagined how deeply this club, this city, these people would become part of my life.
Yes, after 9 years at Anfield, we learnt yesterday evening that it is now time for Mo to go. Mohamed Salah announced he is leaving Liverpool, where we can have a quick chat with Adam Patel, BBC Sports dedicated Liverpool reporter who joins us. Hi, Adam.
Hi, Mike.
So unlike the big shock announcement from Jurgen Klopp a couple of years ago that caught everyone by surprise, this news from Salah yesterday, I guess, wasn't totally unexpected, was it?
Yeah, I guess it was always going to come as some kind of a surprise, given that's all we've known for 9 years with Mohamed Salah and Liverpool. But ultimately, after events early in the season where he had his explosive interview at Leeds, where he said someone at the club wanted him out and that his relationship with the manager had broken down, then perhaps this sort of ending was always going to be likely. And obviously things were patched up afterwards. And I think thankfully for Liverpool fans, there was no sort of ugly exit in January. And at least now Salah gets the opportunity to somewhat bow out on his own terms in the summer.
Two Premier League titles, a Champions League, FIFA Club World Cup, UEFA Super Cup, FA Cup, two EFL Cups, the Community Shield thrown in there as well. I mean, he's won the lot, hasn't he? What next for Salah? He's 33, still got some playing left in those legs, you would think. Is he really going to Saudi?
It's fascinating to think about, actually, because when they gave him the new contract at the end of last season, I mean, he got the most goals in the Premier League, the most assists, and the belief is very much that this is still an elite player, but obviously we've seen the drop-off this season. Now, Salah still firmly believes that he should be starting week in, week out. And I guess that's what's got to come into question here, because if he still thinks he can compete at the best level, then there might be a move elsewhere. His agent said yesterday that, look, even we don't know where he's going. But like you say, Saudi's an obvious link. Also, there's America as a potential place that he could go to. But at the moment, no one really knows. And like his agent said yesterday, that even they don't know where he's going. They just know that he won't be a Liverpool player come next season.
And as for Liverpool briefly, Adam, they have a big wage earner off the books, don't they now? 400 grand a week, reportedly, Salah was on. Where will they turn to next, do you think?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, given their summer spending last season with Alexander Isak coming in, Premier League record signing, Florian Wirtz for over 100 million, Hugo Ekitike as well, then The direction in their attacking strategy was clear. So obviously there's going to be, well, the opportunity for all of them to step up and take more responsibility next season. They're in the market for another winger. They've also got the young lad, teenager Rio Ngamoha, coming up the ranks. So obviously he'll get the chance to step up. So it's not like they're short of options from wingers, but obviously the fact of the matter is they will probably never replace Salah in terms of the goals and the assists. But what they can do is hopefully get someone that can help them win more silverware.
Yeah, he will certainly go down as a Liverpool legend. Adam Patel, BBC Sport Liverpool reporter, many thanks for that this morning. More reflections on Mo Salah in the next hour of the programme, looking at his cultural impact on Merseyside. Looking forward to hearing the great Sue Johnston on the programme before 9 o'clock. And just to say, Nick and Anna, Salah's departure from Liverpool, for me, means it's quite sad, because we will no longer hear what, in my opinion, is one of the best adapted football chants of recent years. Mo Salah! Played this on the programme before, but for me it's brilliant, a reworking of the 1990s James Britpop classic Sit Down to Mo Salah, but we'll be hearing it no more.
I'm willing to bite my lip to attribute one of the great players of our era
fabulous, fabulous player. Thanks, Mark. We'll be talking about him, as you say, more in the next hour. Now, let's look ahead to the moral maze this evening. William Crawley takes over the hot seat. Here he is with a preview.
Later today, Dame Sarah Mullally becomes the first female Archbishop of Canterbury. It's an historic moment, but not everyone's on board. Hundreds of churches still won't accept women priests, and gay couples are banned from marriage in its precincts. What some see as doctrinal integrity, others call discrimination at the heart of a national institution. Because the Church of England isn't like other churches. It's part of the Constitution. Supporters say it's there for everyone, giving a moral voice to public life. Critics say it dodges equality law while enjoying privilege without accountability. So in a secular, diverse Britain, can we morally justify an established church? The Moral Maze, after the news at 8 tonight.
There is so much going on in today's weather that I'm not sure the forecast is going to clear anything up for you, but I'll share it anyway. A mixture of sunny breaks, patchy cloud and showers, heavy and sundry at times during the afternoon, with some early snow in Northern Hills.
don't give up the day job. Now, what's coming up on the programme? How should families and businesses be protected from soaring energy prices? A question we will explore with the man who wants to be Chancellor, the Shadow Chancellor, Mel Stride.
On BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson in London, Anna Foster in Salford, and at 27 minutes to 8, a summary of the news with Caroline Nichols.
President Trump has insisted that Iran badly wants a deal to end the four-week conflict. He hinted at a very significant prize given to the US by Iranian negotiators. Reports in the US say it's drawn up a plan for ending the war, but Tehran has denied that talks are taking place. Israel and Iran have continued to exchange airstrikes. Tehran has told the UN that ships which aren't hostile will be allowed to pass through the Strait of Hormuz, a key oil route which it's been threatening. The head of the world's biggest asset management company has warned the future of the world economy depends on whether Iran continues to threaten the security of energy and shipping. Larry Fink, who runs the American firm BlackRock, told the BBC that if oil prices reached $150 a barrel, it would trigger a global recession. Currently, Brent crude is trading at around $100 a barrel. Inflation, as measured by the Consumer Prices Index, was unchanged last month at 3%. The figure doesn't take into account the period after the war began in the Middle East. The BBC has learnt that East Kent Hospital's NHS Trust waited 2 days before raising the alarm about the first case of meningitis, a delay which some experts have called indefensible. Doctors have a legal duty to report cases of the disease to the UK Health Security Agency as soon as they're suspected. The hospital acknowledged it had missed an opportunity, explaining it had been waiting for test results. A court in New Mexico has ordered the owner of Instagram, Facebook and WhatsApp to pay $375 million for misleading users about the safety of its platforms for children. Officials in New Mexico say this marks the first time that a US state has successfully sued the company Meta over child safety issues. Meta says it will appeal against the verdict.
Thank you, Caroline. It's 25 to 8 now. The military build-up on the border had suggested it, and now we know that Israel's military is planning to occupy a swathe of southern Lebanon unless Hezbollah is fully disarmed after Israel's defence minister, Israel Katz, confirmed it yesterday. Hundreds of thousands of people in Lebanon have been ordered to leave their homes in the south. Many are now living on the streets or in temporary shelters, and Israel has been blowing up key bridges over the Litani River between north and south, which cuts many of them off. The Lebanese government has been struggling to remove Hezbollah's weapons, so it does still possess them and it has been using them against Israel. Many Lebanese people are angry that Hezbollah has dragged them into conflict again. Lebanon's president has called for negotiations to resolve the issue, but Israel didn't take him up on the offer. Well, I've been speaking to Ali, who's been displaced along with his extended family, and he left his village in the south following a warning from the IDF.
In the first time, we think we have to stay for just 4 hours just to see what's going to happen. But the hours is come to be days, and now we don't know if going to be months. Now I split my family. I and part of my family stay in the same place. I'm still in South Lebanon now. But my child just born, just 2-3 months, I have to... And my grandmother, almost 100 years, cannot keep him in this area. We have to send him some to Beirut. My wife and my child sent him to Beirut.
Are you worried, Ali, that you might get separated from them, because as the bridges over the Litani River are being blown up, it will make it will cut off the south and the north.
Exactly, exactly. This coming to be one of the worried thing, because now even to start get the stuff from outside start to be complicated, and we have only one bridge to connect us to the other side.
And you've managed to find a place for you to stay and for your family to stay, because obviously for many people, and given the economic problems that Lebanon has had for years now, for a lot of people, they don't have anywhere at all to go.
Mm. Now, many of my family, friend and family, in the meantime, he find place, as I say, to stay immediately. And he, you know, he spent sometimes 10 times more than normal price, because the people also in Lebanon start not so supportive to this condition. I know from so many family outside now, I think more than 30% is still no stay in home, and majority still in school, and something like this, and in very terrible situation. No toilet, no place to take shower and whatever. Even the other part who can support himself, I don't think he will take long time, and he will start fail also, because the economy in last 1 year and 2 years in South Lebanon was very bad.
That is Ali, who's displaced with his family in the south of Lebanon. Well, Dr. Nasser Yassin is director of the Arab Center for Research and Policy Studies in Beirut. He's also an expert policy advisor and a former minister in the Lebanese government as well. Dr. Yassin, thank you for joining us. I think it's useful for people who maybe don't know Lebanon well to understand where Hezbollah is in the country's society, in its politics. It plays a very particular role.
Good morning, Anna, and thanks for hosting me. Well, Hezbollah has different arms. Hezbollah is part of the current government. They've been part of many governments for the past decades, last 20 years at least. And they have also civilian organizations. They have a parliamentary bloc, a significant one in this parliament. And also they have a military faction that has been active as a resistance movement before the year 2000, when Israel occupied areas, large areas of South Lebanon, and they acted as a resistance movement. But then this continued after year 2000, and that was part of a continuous but futile dialogue in Lebanon to disarm and to decommission. So here we are, we're still in this quagmire. Israel is still doing its strikes on Lebanon continuously for the past 3 weeks. And Hezbollah has engaged in this conflict that majority of Lebanese don't see it as theirs. And we are stuck at the moment between a rock and a hard place, between Iran's, you know, attacks and reaction to the campaign against them, and Israel's and Netanyahu's ongoing and endless wars in the region for the past 3-4 years. So this is where we are.
Yeah, you're right. It is a quagmire, and so difficult for civilians in Lebanon, because absolutely, as we were reflecting with Ali there, it's been such a difficult few years with the economic crisis. And the government, which is made up in a very particular way and was designed that way after the Civil War, it makes it very hard to achieve things. And the time when you were in the government was when it was a more technocratic government, where people were brought in to try and actually move the country forward. But when it comes to disarmament, it is really, really difficult.
It is difficult, like in any country going through non-state actors being armed. In the case of Lebanon, they're armed even more than the Lebanese army, more than the armed forces. So it requires a lot of dialogue and diplomacy, but unfortunately it's not working. So we tend to keep pushing the can and, you know, get ourselves into these crises. And the as you mentioned, people like Ali are suffering because of this war and, of course, of the many, many crises. And I mean, at the moment,
Around 20% of the population has been displaced. Around 1 million people. You can do the, you know, the proportion of this to a country like England. Around 18% of the areas were asked to evacuate by the Israeli forces and by the evacuation orders. Imagine southwest of England has been ordered to evacuate by an invading army. And you can do all the reality on the ground of these people trying to find shelter in, you know, collective areas and collective shelter in the streets. Some tents are still there in Beirut, you know, sleeping on the rough. And the response to this from the international community and agencies, or from the government, the current government, has been very slow for many, many reasons, including limited funding, including lack of support coming from abroad for this war, for this response, I mean, against this war. Yeah. So, I mean, it's a challenge, but I think we cannot but stop the current war in Lebanon. Israel has to stop its endless wars in the region, and they have to withdraw from Lebanon. Their occupation of parts of South Lebanon and their expansion towards the one of the major rivers, like 20, 25 kilometers in Lebanon from the borders, is going to create even more layers of complexity and challenges, and will bring legitimacy to resistance movements and to armed groups like Hezbollah. Yeah, so they have to withdraw.
And yeah, it's a difficult moment, isn't it?
Back to diplomacy, and diplomacy can be the only way forward.
Yeah, it's a difficult moment, Dr. Nasser Yassin, isn't it? As Israel says, well, if the Lebanese government doesn't disarm Hezbollah, we'll do it ourselves. The government says, give us more time, allow us to negotiate. And it's certainly a conflict at the moment that I think is suffering from being in the shadow of the war that's happening in Iran right now. That's Dr. Nasser Yassin, who's director of the Arab Centre for Research and Policy Studies in Beirut.
It is 16 minutes to 8 now. Public satisfaction with the NHS is on the up, according to a new survey, but from a historically low base. So how much does that tell us about whether the NHS is really recovering post the pandemic? Sarah Woolnow joins us. She's chief executive of the King's Fund. Morning to you. Thanks
Good
for
morning.
Coming to the studio. It's up a bit. Is that a reason for cheer?
Yeah, it's up a bit. So it's up to 26% of the public satisfied. There's also been a drop in dissatisfaction of 8 points. So that's significant. But as you say, it's from a really low base. And if you lift the bonnet and you ask more specific questions to members of the public about individual services, dentistry, A&E, actually, there haven't been significant shifts in satisfaction. So it looks as though we're beginning to see a recovery, but it's fragile.
And does that lack of an improvement when it comes to GPs and A&E reflect the reality in terms of how the performance is?
Well, there are green shoots of improvement, but they're not dramatic. So you are seeing waiting lists, of course, from a very high base, stabilise and fall ever so slightly. In some of the patient experience surveys, GP patient experience, maternity, small improvements. So it looks as though, and of course, this will be a cause for some optimism and relief across the service, there is an uptick in satisfaction and performance, but it's fragile and it's from a really low base. This is the third lowest level of satisfaction recorded in the 42-year history of this survey.
And it's interesting, isn't it, that different people regard this in rather different ways. The young, much less optimistic.
Yes.
Than older people.
Yeah, two interesting points. One is older people generally more satisfied. There is some correlation between if you've used NHS services and if you're older, you're more likely to have used them in the past year. Older people much more satisfied than younger people, but also there's not much optimism about the future, and particularly for some people supporting different political parties, so reform supporters far less likely to be optimistic about the future than Labour supporters, and as an example. So you see really interesting demographic and political differences.
Green supporters as well. In other words, in a sense, choosing to support one of those parties seen as outside the mainstream traditionally is a bit of an indication that you think things in general aren't going very well.
Exactly that. So we know there are low levels of trust in public services and a dissatisfaction with the way things are working. And that seems to be bearing out along political lines when it comes to the NHS.
Now, we're going to hear from the Health Secretary in the next hour of the programme, who's responsible for the NHS in England. And he'll talk about some of the changes he's trying to make. he and the managers there must be deeply worried, as so many people running any form of business or organisation now are, about the rise in energy prices.
Yeah, we know, of course, the NHS, although it received a pretty generous settlement, the budget remains very tight. So any unfunded cost pressures bearing down on hospitals and other parts of the NHS will be a cause for worry. There's also a potentially triple whammy, of course, when it comes to energy costs. Patients having to travel to hospitals, staff, NHS staff having to bear extra costs. So any pressure of this type will be a cause for concern, I think, particularly when so much focus is, can we continue to see improvement?
Sarah Woolnough, Chief Executive of the King's Fund. Thank you.
It's 12 minutes to 8 now. Time for Thought for the Day. And the speaker this morning is the Reverend Dr. Giles Fraser, the Vicar of St. Anne's Church, Kew. Good morning.
Good morning. Today, it's 9 months to Christmas. Or to put it another way, it is the feast day of the conception of Jesus Christ, which is no doubt why this day was chosen as a perfect day on which the first ever Archbishop of Canterbury to have conceived and born children will be enthroned on the historic seat of St. Augustine. A long time coming, many will say. It was over 20 years ago that the novelist Dan Brown wrote his largely fanciful account of the Church's centuries-long suppression of what he called the divine feminine. Critics rounded on the Da Vinci Code as rather silly and badly researched, but there was a strong element of truth to it. Throughout history, Christianity has emphasised a deliberately gendered version of the divine, an all-male priesthood bowing down to an old man with a beard. And indeed, when this divinity made an appearance here on earth, it was as a male version of the species. Our Father is how we begin our most famous prayer. But centuries before our current concern over pronouns, the Bible was far less emphatic about the divine being exclusively male. The book of Isaiah refers to God as mother, the Psalms to God as a midwife. The opening verses of the Bible speak of the breath or spirit of God, ruach in Hebrew, as female, an aspect of the divine life that Christians will come to know as the Holy Spirit. And as scholars have noted, one of the ancient Hebrew names for God, El Shaddai, may well be related etymologically to the Hebrew word for breasts, shad. There is nothing liberal or trendy in pointing out that what we call God the Father is not a man. God is beyond gender. Even so, the use of exclusively male pronouns for the divine has often given this misleading impression. As is commonly pointed out, words often fail when it comes to God, but words are all we have. Except that's not quite true. We also have pictures, and a woman, and a nurse, and a mother sitting on the throne of St. Augustine is a picture of the Church through which many may well come to think differently about the nature of God. This is a great deal for one human being to bear, and I suspect it may feel to the new Archbishop like a kind of symbolic overload, which adds to the weight of what is already an impossible job. Not least because some, for what they'd see as doctrinal reasons, do not accept the priestly ministry of women, still less that of an archbishop, whilst others, like me, will rejoice. But whatever your view, and if you are the praying type, as I am, Archbishop Sarah will need all of our prayers today as she embarks on this most historic and symbolic of journeys.
That was Thought for the Day with the Reverend Dr. Giles Fraser. The time now is 9 minutes to eight. If Iran remains a threat when the fighting stops, if oil prices stay high whenever this war ends, it'll have a profound implications for the world economy. That is the warning we're hearing this morning from one of the most influential figures in world markets, Larry Fink, the boss of US financial giant BlackRock. It follows the warning from the head of the International Energy Authority, who said the energy crisis now was worse than the twin oil shocks of the 1970s and the fallout of the Ukraine war combined. How then should the Chancellor prepare us for that problem and perhaps protect us from it? Let's discuss that with the man who wants her job, the Shadow Chancellor, Conservative Mel Stride, joins us now. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Nick.
How serious a threat to the economy do you think we are now facing?
Well, it's clearly a very significant potential external shock. If oil goes up to the kind of 150 $5 a barrel and remains at that level for a significant period of time, then things like global recession are possible. Certainly, the import of very high inflation into the UK would be expected to happen. That would have consequences for living standards, but also for the cost of servicing our national debt and huge pressure on our public finances. But I think having said that, Nick, what I would say is that the important thing that a Chancellor should be doing in those circumstances is building a resilient economy, something that can lean into those shocks and weather the storm. And I'm afraid that's not what we've seen with this Labour government. Very high taxes, low and anemic growth, lots of borrowing and spending, that stoked up inflation. Inflation going up quite apart from what's going on in the Middle East incidentally, the highest level of inflation in the G7 last year, and expected, irrespective of the Middle East, to be going up to the highest level this year too. So you've got to get the fundamentals right. Mm-hmm. It is flat, yeah. But it's not coming down, and it's 50% higher than it was on the day of the last general election.
Let's discuss in our limited time what you would do now rather than your view about we shouldn't have started from here if we could. You Conservatives have argued that really the key thing now is to drill for more North Sea oil and gas. Will you concede that whatever the arguments for it, it will make no difference to the bills of households or businesses this winter or indeed the next if the government were to follow your advice?
Well, that's not entirely true, because, of course, if you're drilling and extracting more oil and gas, you're generating revenues, you're generating tax revenues as well, which in turn, of course, strengthens the public finances and gives the government more latitude, actually, to help people out when they are in need. The other...
But it's indirect, just to be clear. Well, in other words, your argument is it would raise tax revenue. You're conceding, I think, aren't you, that this is a global market for oil and gas, the price is set globally... It doesn't matter if we produce more. That doesn't alter the price. We can't suddenly get, in inverted commas, cheap energy as a result.
You can raise a lot of revenue. You can protect a lot of jobs. You can improve the balance of payments by not importing all these hydrocarbons, but producing them yourselves, which, in fact, would actually strengthen the pound and make all imports a bit cheaper and bear down on inflation, including our energy imports as well.
It takes a hell of a long time to exploit a new oil and gas field.
It's complete madness. Whilst you're right, Nick, that it's a global price for oil and a regional price for gas, the reality is that leaving all these assets in the ground when, for example, in the case of gas, by not extracting them, we're actually just simply importing them from Norway, which is extracting that gas from the same basin that we are neglecting to do that extraction from, is absolute lunacy. It's costing jobs, it's costing tax revenues, it's making the economy weaker, and it's damaging our energy security because it means we're more dependent on others.
To be clear, lots of oil and gas is coming out of the North Sea, is coming out of the ground. You just think even more should.
There are two fields out there which are ready to go. Jackdaw for gas and Rosebank for oil, which could be producing within a matter of months if the government gave them the go-ahead. And Jackdaw is 1.5 million homes that could be supplied.
Another issue. I mean, the Chancellor said yesterday that she had learned the lessons of history. She got the support of your predecessor, Sir Jeremy Hunt, who was Chancellor of the Conservatives, by saying we should give support for those who need it most. Will you Conservatives support that, even in the face of a headline like there is in the Daily Mail today, saying the middle class will feel the pain? Isn't the truth that the lack of money that the country now has means the middle class will have to absorb the pain in order for the taxpayer to help those in the greatest need?
Well, look, if you're going to step in and intervene in the economy, you've got to be able to afford to do it. And as I think I've argued, the economy is in a very bad position due to the choices of this Chancellor. What the Chancellor should be doing right now is getting on top of public spending, particularly
the welfare bill.
So the answer to
the question... Do you accept that help has to be targeted, and targeted help translated means the relatively better off, what we sometimes call the middle class, will not be able to get help with their bills. They will have to tighten their belts.
Well, I think before we even get to that stage, there's something else the government should do, and that is to get about a 20% reduction in energy bills off people's backs by scrapping carbon taxes and the kind of green subsidies that are resting within those bills. They should scrap the fuel duty rise that they're looking at bringing in September, and they should also get on top of that oil and gas extraction
now,
that we've been discussing.
Now I've let you set out that agenda. Yeah. Could you give me an answer to my question? Do you Conservatives accept that targeted help means the middle class will have to absorb the pain. That is the reality of the economic situation we are in.
Nick, we have to look at the detail of what the government comes forward with. But the point, overarching point that I'm making is you shouldn't be borrowing money to do this. You shouldn't be raising taxes to do it because that damages the economy. You should be getting on top of public spending, particularly the welfare bill, driving that welfare bill down, getting people off benefits and into work. Then you can afford to provide support. And at the moment,
would it be impolite of me to suggest that you're changing the subject when I'm asking you a plain question?
Well, I think it'd be very impolite, actually, Nick, because I think I am answering the question, which
I
is to say that we don't know.
The question
we
don't that the middle know. Class will have to we, pay
we,
the price.
Well, we don't know what the government is going to have to come forward with. We don't know where the oil price is going to go. We don't know where inflation is going to go. So we don't know what the proposal will look like.
Well, we look forward to having you back on the programme.
There are choices. Yeah. And the biggest choice of all that the government can make is to control welfare, control Got spending, it. And then be able to help.
Sam Elstride, thank you very much indeed, the Shadow Chancellor for the Conservatives. Who will come back and answer that question on a future occasion.
Let's check the weather. Here's Chris Fawkes.
Hi, Anna. And it's looking a lot colder today thanks to gusty northwesterly winds. You'll notice the change as a polar air mass sweeps in across the UK. Today is a day of sunshine and blustery showers, with a lot of the showers coming through with hailstorms in. There's also some sleet, and if you head high enough up in Scotland and northern England in particular, you might come across a little bit of snow as well. So for England and Wales, loads of showers packing in on a very gusty northwesterly wind. Those winds gusting at around 40 to 50 miles an hour today, blowing the showers rapidly across the sky. Nowhere's immune from seeing a shower, but it's across northeast England that will probably see the fewest of those showers. A number of them will come through with hailstorms mixed in, particularly as we head into the early afternoon. And in places, I wouldn't be surprised if we see hailstorms completely covering roads and pavements in hail in one or two spots. Now, temperatures today will be well below average, around 7 to 10 Celsius, and feeling cold in that northwesterly wind. For Northern Ireland and Scotland, we've also got lots of showers here too, quite a lot of them coming through with sleet and across some of the higher mountains, particularly above around 400 metres elevation. You will probably see some snow mixed in as well. Temperatures today struggling. We're looking at highs here of around 6 to 8 Celsius, but just 4 in Shetland. Now, overnight tonight we're looking at quite a widespread frost, although showers will continue to run in around coastal areas. Tomorrow, another quite unsettled day, but showers tending to become confined to northern and eastern Scotland and running down the North Sea coastal counties of England as well. Otherwise, a fair amount of dry weather, but it will feel cold again with temperatures staying below average. That's the latest.
Thank you, Chris. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster in Salford and Nick Robinson in London.
Good morning, it's 8 o'clock on Wednesday, the 25th of March. The headlines this morning: President Trump has said Iran is desperate for a deal to end the war and that it's given the US a very big present. But Tehran has said talks aren't taking place and has continued attacks on nearby countries. The head of the world's biggest asset management firm, BlackRock, has warned that allowing Iran to carry on threatening shipping could lead to a global recession. We'll hear from Larry Fink at 8:30. And an NHS trust in Kent has been criticised after it emerged that it took 2 days to raise the alert about the first meningitis case.
Coming up in the next half hour, the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, on that delay and on signs in a patient survey that some people do think the NHS is getting better. We'll hear about how you cope with the departure of the hero of many Liverpool fans, and indeed many football fans who support whatever team, of Mo Salah, the diehard Liverpool fan. The actor Sue Johnson will tell us how she's coming to terms with it all. And what can Dutch school kids, after the Netherlands ban mobiles, smart watches and tablets in the classroom, teach school children here about life without social media?
I think you would get used to it, yeah, relatively fast.
Yeah, maybe now we are a little bit more in the moment. In the breaks, nobody's on their phones.
That's then the new normal.
The news is now read for us by Caroline Nichols.
President Trump has insisted that Tehran badly wants a deal to end the 4-week conflict. He hinted at a very significant prize given to the US by Iranian negotiators. Reports in the US say it's drawn up a plan for ending the war, but Iran has denied that talks are taking place. Crude oil prices have fallen in early trading, with a barrel of Brent crude now standing at just under $100. From Washington, here's our North America correspondent, David Willis.
Donald Trump told reporters Iran was, in his words, desperate for a deal to end the war. He insisted talks were underway and added cryptically that the US had received an expensive gift from Iran, which he said showed that he was dealing with the right people. Who those people are, he again refused to say. Tehran insists there are no such talks and the president is simply seeking to steady nerves on the financial markets. But reports here and in Israel suggest the Trump administration has proposed a one-month ceasefire during which both sides would consider a 15-point plan to address Iran's missile development. Mr. Trump again surprised reporters by saying that Iran had already agreed to the United States' principal demand, the dismantling of its nuclear weapons program. Pakistan, a key US ally in the region, is acting as mediator and has offered to host talks between the two nations. But as President Trump reaches for a diplomatic solution, some have suggested he may simply be buying time with thousands more US troops currently on their way to the region.
Israel and Iran have continued to exchange airstrikes. Tehran has told the UN that ships which aren't hostile will be allowed to pass through the Strait of Hormuz, a key oil route which it's been threatening. From Jerusalem, our correspondent James Waterhouse reports.
Explosions could be heard in Tehran and plumes of smoke were rising over buildings as Israel confirmed it had carried out more airstrikes. It's as the United Nations nuclear watchdog, the IAEA, says it's been informed by the Iranians that another missile has hit the site of the Bushehr nuclear power plant, but that no buildings were damaged. Iran is still returning fire. It claims to have launched missiles at Israel, Jordan, Bahrain, and towards Kuwait, where officials say drones hit an oil tank, causing a fire at its international airport.
The head of the world's biggest asset management company has warned the future of the world economy depends on whether Iran continues to threaten the security of energy and shipping. Larry Fink runs the US firm BlackRock, which manages $14 trillion of savers' money. He told the BBC that if oil prices reached $150 a barrel, it would trigger a global recession. Larry Fink was speaking exclusively to the BBC's business editor, Simon Jack.
It's not so much how long it goes on, it's how it ends. That's how the boss of the world's biggest money manager, BlackRock, views the crisis in the Gulf. Larry Fink suggests that either Iran peacefully reintegrates back into the global economy and oil prices fall back below pre-war levels, or it doesn't, with profound economic consequences.
If there's a cessation of war and yet Iran remains a threat to trade, a threat to the Straits of Hormuz, then I would argue that we could have years of above $100, closer to $150 oil, we'll have global recession.
Larry Fink also dismissed suggestions that the trillions being poured into AI investment was a bubble. In his annual letter to the CEOs of the companies in which BlackRock invests, he said AI would replace many white-collar jobs and more people should pursue technical skills rather than go to university.
The government has insisted that the UK has a diverse and resilient energy supply in response to comments made by the chief executive of Shell, Waleed Sawan, that a fuel shortage could affect Europe within weeks. Mr. Sawan told a conference in Texas that there had been a ripple effect because of the war, which had already led to parts of Asia cutting energy consumption. Inflation, as measured by the Consumer Prices Index, remained at 3% in February. Rises in the cost of clothing offset cheaper food and travel, but the figures cover the month before the start of the war in the Middle East, which has forced up oil and energy costs. Here's our Deputy Economics Editor, Darshini David.
Higher spring clothing and furniture prices offset weaker ones for petrol to leave inflation unchanged in February. But that drop in fuel prices has been more than reversed since. The war in the Middle East is expected to derail a hoped-for drop in inflation in the coming months, especially if domestic energy bills rise in the summer and if the impact of higher oil and gas prices spreads to other areas such as food. Economists think inflation could end the year at around 3.5%, considerably above the target, but still far below the levels seen a few years ago at the start of the war in Ukraine. But it all depends on the future direction of energy markets and any further help the government delivers.
The BBC has learned that East Kent Hospital's NHS Trust waited 2 days before raising the alarm about the first case of meningitis, a delay which some experts have called indefensible. Doctors have a legal duty to report cases of the disease to the UK Health Security Agency as soon as they're suspected. The hospital acknowledged it had missed an opportunity, explaining it had been waiting for test results. Paul Hunter is the Professor of Medicine at the University of East Anglia. He told us that it's critical that hospitals follow the correct procedure.
This is a disease that you can deteriorate and get very sick very quickly. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 hours can make the difference between somebody who survives well and somebody who either dies or survives but with severe life-changing disabilities. And that's why notification is required urgently.
A court in New Mexico has ordered the owner of Instagram, Facebook and WhatsApp to pay $375 million for misleading users about the safety of its platforms for children. Officials in New Mexico say this marks the first time that a state has successfully sued the company Meta over child safety issues. The firm plans to appeal. A group of survivors have hit back at the high-profile associates of the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein for claiming that they never saw any wrongdoing. In a special programme for BBC Newsnight, the women said, "You couldn't be friends with Epstein and not know what was going on." Victoria Derbyshire reports from Washington, D.C.
For decades, Jeffrey Epstein is believed to have sexually abused hundreds of girls and young women. Pictures released by the US Department of Justice show him socialising with many high-profile people, including royalty, millionaire businessmen and UK and US politicians. There's no suggestion that appearing in the documents implies any wrongdoing. BBC Newsnight has heard from a group of survivors who've said they believe that those in Epstein's orbit, including the rich and powerful, knew what was going on. They said everyone saw what was happening, from the cab driver to the chef to the maid.
Dame Sarah Mullally will be installed as the first female leader of the Church of England in a service at Canterbury Cathedral this afternoon. The congregation will include members of the royal family as well as nurses, reflecting her career before becoming a cleric. Her predecessor as Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, resigned over the church's handling of an abuse scandal. In a BBC interview, Dame Sarah said she recognised the historic nature of her appointment.
Whilst I sort of try and get my head around being the Archbishop, I recognise the significance of being the first female Archbishop. But I am also aware of the women that have supported me in my ministry and also the men as well. And part of the installation service will have women's voices right the way through it.
A patient who persuaded a would-be bomber not to blow up a hospital in Leeds will receive the George Medal for gallantry. Nathan Newby, who's 35, spent several hours talking to Mohammed Farouk to prevent the atrocity. Farouk asked him for a cuddle and eventually told him to phone the police before he changed his mind. Emma Glasby reports.
Nathan Newby was being treated at St James's Hospital in Leeds in 2023 when he saw a man acting suspiciously outside. Mohammed Farouk had a pressure cooker bomb with 10 kilograms of explosives and told Mr Newby about his plot to attack the hospital. Mr Newby spent more than 2 hours persuading him to abandon the plan. Farouk was later jailed for 37 years. Mr Newby's bravery is being recognised today.
Emma Glasby reporting.
Thank you, Caroline. It's 10 minutes past eight. There are, once again, several competing and very different narratives about the war in Iran and whether it's likely to end soon. On the one hand, Donald Trump says the Iranians want to make a deal to end the fighting, in his words, so badly. He says talks are happening now and that they're fruitful.
They did something yesterday that was amazing, actually. They gave us a present, and the present arrived today. It was a very big present worth a tremendous amount of money. And I'm not going to tell you what that present is, but it was a very significant prize.
Well, the markets listened to that. The price of oil fell again this morning. Iran also now says what it calls non-hostile vessels can pass through the Strait of Hormuz. So all of that is the positive take. But there are a whole other set of circumstances to take into consideration. Iran called Mr. Trump's declaration of negotiations fake news, claiming no discussions were being had.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. قدرت راهبردی که از آن دم می‌زدید تبدیل به شکست راهبردی شده.
That's an Iranian military spokesman on state TV saying, has the level of your internal conflict reached the point where you're negotiating with yourselves? This is part of the speech that you heard him making there. He also said at another point in it, someone like us will never come to terms with someone like you. Not now, not ever. Add to that the fact that the US is sending thousands more troops to the Middle East, raising speculation again that there might yet be plans for a ground operation. And overnight, there have been fresh strikes on Tehran and on parts of Israel as well. And none of that looks like a resolution is imminent. So how do we work out where the truth actually lies? Well, a good start is to speak to our international editor, Jeremy Bowen. Jeremy, morning. How can you illuminate us in the middle of all of this?
Well, it feels like there are two different worlds going on, two different accounts of what's happening. There is clear evidence that there are intermediaries who are passing messages between the two sides. That is clear, and the Pakistanis are paying they have a border with Iran, and they are playing a very important role in all of that, and even offered to host talks. So that is certainly going on. But there is a massive lack of trust between the two sides, and particularly between Iran and the US, because don't forget that talks were going on when it was attacked on the 28th of February and last summer. And even those talks appeared to be going quite well, at least going in the right direction, according to some negotiators. So therefore, I think that suggests that while the Iranians might be prepared to negotiate, they believe now that they are in a position where on the key point, which is traffic through the Strait of Hormuz, where 20% of world oil and gas go, and that is the root of this global economic dislocation that's happening as a result of the war. The key thing is, what is the deal to reopen that waterway fully to safe international traffic? And that is the chokehold that Iran has, and that is the key to its asymmetric strategy, which I think has deprived the United States actually of the initiative in this war. And I think in Washington they're feeling that, even though they're not admitting to it. And I think definitely in Tehran or wherever the leadership is, they're also feeling it too.
So is it fair to say, Jeremy, at this point, despite whatever was discussed in the build-up about helping the Iranian people, about regime change, about nuclear weapons, whatever it is, ultimately, it will be the impact on the global economy that will lead what happens next?
That's driving everything at the moment. As for regime change, well, Trump came up with a fanciful suggestion in his his remarks in the White House yesterday, that because they've killed the supreme leader and a lot of the people around him, then it's regime change. No, it's not. They're changing some faces. The regime is actually one of the key points here, is that the US, and I think Israel, massively underestimated the resilience of the regime, the way that they have decentralized, the way that they're working, the way they're hitting back. Donald Trump also said that one of the key reasons why they are desperate for a deal, in his belief, is that their communication systems have been destroyed. He's not reflecting the fact that, in a sense, they expected that, so therefore they have decentralized things. This feels, Anna, I think, like a crossroads moment, because, you know, very soon, if not now, the president is going to have to face a choice between getting deeper into the war, ground troops are on the way, or how does he end this? Can he present a deal as a victory? He would need to get a concession out of the Israelis, perhaps, which Iran would accept. And then he might try and have to frame that as a triumph. And one thing I want to add about this business of troops coming is that while, yes, they're on the way, there are something, two Marine expeditionary units, 2,200 Marines each, maybe 4,000 airborne troops. That, if we think back to the 2003 invasion of Iraq, there were hundreds of thousands of troops who were taking part in that, up to 300,000 troops at its peak. So there is no comparison with that. However, they might decide that they can seize some islands, some territory, and somehow put pressure on Tehran like that. And I don't think that is going to work, because there is strategic confusion from the outset in the White House, in the mind of Donald Trump. And Iran's regime is using that confusion and exploiting it shrewdly, not just to survive, but to try to dictate the way the war ends. And that, again, goes back to the question of the reopening or otherwise of the Strait of Hormuz.
Yeah, that's interesting looking at it that way. You touched on this as well, Jeremy, but what about Israel, for example? What about the Gulf states? What are their feelings on this particular moment? And are their feelings taken into consideration when these decisions will be made?
I mean, hard to know with Donald Trump. I think that clearly that's part of it. I think in the end he makes decisions because, as he's put it himself, he said a week or two ago, he said, "I'll know when to end this. I'll feel it in my bones." That's how he works and makes policy. He doesn't look into the long-term ramifications of things. He has gut feelings. Israel doesn't want to stop. Israel believes that they're in a position to inflict absolutely irreparable or very, very long generational damage anyway on the Islamic Republic, which it regards with some justification as its most bitter enemy. There's no doubt about that. And as for the Gulf states, while I think they will always try and stay close to America, when the bombing phase of this crisis ends, I think they will reassess just where they're at in terms of their alliance with the United States, which they entered into and allowed American bases in their countries, which, if you think back to the 1990s, was immensely controversial in those countries. Because of that, I think that they will start thinking, well, hang on a minute, how is this actually helping us? How is this making us safe? One very senior Gulf diplomat I spoke to said, after this is over, we're going to have to diversify. That is the word that was being used. And of course, the country which has got very interested in the Gulf and is just watching what's going on is China.
Jeremy, appreciate your insight. As always, thank you. Jeremy Bowen there, our international editor.
It is 19 minutes past eight. Who's going to pay the price for the energy crisis that this war has triggered? That is a question that we've been discussing this morning after the warning from Larry Fink, the boss of the US financial giant BlackRock, who has said that if the oil price hits $150, it's not there yet, but if it were to do that, because Iran was still a threat at the end of this war, then that would trigger a global recession. We're joined now by Wes Streeting, Secretary of State for Health and Social Care, on a day in which he is hailing some improvements in the NHS. We'll come to those in just a moment, Mr. Streeting. Welcome to the programme. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
Can we begin with that anxiety that so many people listening feel this morning about what this will mean for them? And I imagine for your managers inside the NHS, for you, you are worrying about what this energy crisis will mean for the budget of the health service.
That's right. We as a government are concerned on every front. We're concerned for families, we're concerned for businesses, particularly energy intensive industries. And of course, the size and scale of the NHS means that I, in addition to thinking about things like waiting lists and waiting times and all the things that you would expect to be at the forefront of the health secretary's mind, I also keep a sharp eye on how we're doing in terms of our financial performance in the NHS and unwelcome cost pressures. So we're keeping all of this in mind. This is an uncertain situation. That is why the Chancellor has shown through action, not simply words, and that she will do whatever she can with the levers available to help this country weather these unwelcome and unexpected shocks. We've got the energy price cap in place that are keeping bills lower for people over the next few months. We've got the fuel duty freeze that are keeping prices lower than they would otherwise be at the petrol pumps. There are other things this government is doing on cost of living making a real difference. I mean, look at the free childcare that's saving families hundreds of pounds a month. So you can judge this Chancellor through her actions and not simply her words.
But her words are important, given yesterday, weren't they? Because she did talk about not having unfunded, untargeted help. She talked of support for those who need it most. The Daily Mail, no friend of the government, interpret it in this way, and lots of people will, middle class to foot the bill for Reeves Benefit Street fuel bailout. It is the case, isn't it? Targeted means that better off people, and I was putting this to the Shadow Chancellor early in the programme, the middle class will have to feel the pain and tighten their belt. They will not get help.
Or put a different way, I will be feeling as a higher earner in this country a difference in my living costs. Will they be pinching me in the pockets in the same way that they might impact on my mum, who is a cleaner on the minimum wage? No.
And you think is fair and just?
We know that the public finances are in a precarious situation. That's what we inherited. We know that the economy has had to go through a huge amount of strain over the last decade, partly as a result of things like the pandemic, partly as a result of reckless political choices like Liz Truss's mini budget. And the challenge the Chancellor has is she's got to try and drive improvement in the economy, confronting the world as it is, not as we would wish it to be. And I can't tell you how much my heart sank when the Chancellor was delivering the spring statement only weeks ago, where she was able to talk confidently about falling interest rates, falling inflation, wages finally rising fast in the cost of living as a result of the choices she's making, knowing full well, as she did, we all did, that what was going on in Iran would make those numbers and that improvement much harder. But she's confronting that challenge head on. She's making the right choices with the right priorities, and we are better able to weather these shocks as a result of the choices she's made. Can we immunise the country from these challenges? No. But what we can do is support people who need it most, individuals, businesses, the country, the economy, through what is a challenging time.
That phrase, need it most, needs a lot of definition. But now's not the day to drill into that, because announcements will come later. Let us instead turn to what you're responsible for, which is the NHS in England. Now, you've hailed the fact that this important public survey of satisfaction with the health service has gone up this year. There is increased satisfaction. It's fair to point out, isn't it, that for a quarter of people to say they're satisfied with the NHS, it's not exactly a triumph.
Well, I would characterise what we've seen today in terms of patient satisfaction and the improvement that we've driven since we came in, the lowest waiting list for 3 years, the fastest ambulance response times for half a decade, the four-hour waits this winter, the best they've been for 4 years, as grounds for optimism, but not cause for complacency. The NHS is finally on the road to recovery, but there's a lot of road ahead. My foot down is on the accelerator, and we're determined to not only continue to drive improvement in the NHS, but to drive faster improvement.
That was our plan when we came in. Is there a danger of complacency there, when 1 in 10 patients who attended the big A&E units in England spent more than 12 hours in A&E? Yes, there are signs that it's not as bad as it was. It is still pretty bad for a lot of people, isn't it?
Yeah, and I hope that what I've said consistently, actually, as Health and Social Care Secretary, and what I'm saying again today in a speech in East London, where I'm accounting for the improvement that we are driving, but also talking about what comes next, that I'm not remotely complacent. But two things are true at the same time. The NHS is improving, and the NHS is still not good enough. Both of those things are true. It is important that people hear both things, because this country, if we're not careful, will go from pessimism to fatalism, not just a fear that things might not improve, but a conviction that things can't improve. That is a bad place for a country to be.
In that context, is it wise to use the phrase drain the swamp to describe the people who run the NHS? Because you have, right in the Telegraph today, talked about sacking poorly performing managers in the NHS. But use the phrase, which seems to be designed to kind of get shared on social media, drain the swamp. What is the swamp?
The swamp of cynicism, Nick. Which you are in danger of swimming
yes,
in.
I thought you were saying that with some feeling there.
But that's your job. No, look, more seriously, let me take on this point, because I think we've got to draw sometimes the distinction between the service and the people who are working in it. To the extent that even in some of the most challenged trusts, there are brilliant people busting a gut, and as they do so, are themselves suffering a moral injury. Because if I feel ashamed seeing people on trolleys in corridors as the health secretary, imagine how the staff feel who are working in those conditions, also feeling that degree of shame.
But in terms of what it means sacking people, does it?
Well, we already have been. And the reason why you haven't seen headlines about individuals and their heads being on spike, naming and shaming, is because I'm not in the business of humiliating people to try and look tough politically. What I am in the business of doing is quietly, effectively and efficiently moving on poor performing senior leaders where they are not delivering the improvement that's needed. And that's why today I'm also announcing the 5 trusts where we've had stubborn underperformance, where I'm sending in NHS veterans with experience of turnaround to drive improvement in North Cumbria, in Mid and South Essex, in Hull, in Northern Lincolnshire and Goole, and in East Kent. Those trusts have been stubbornly underperforming. That's not good for patients in those areas. It's also not good for the staff in those trusts either, in terms of how they feel, in terms of their job satisfaction. And to greet your challenge of the risk of complacency, the one thing I would say quite transparently is that when I look at the improvement that we are leading in the NHS, what I am seeing when I drill into the numbers is that some higher performing trusts are masking underperformance in other areas.
Which brings us
and
finally,
if you're
if
someone who lives in one of those areas that isn't performing, it's no good me telling you it's better for someone else somewhere else. I've got to make sure we've got consistent improvement everywhere.
I rush you because you have other interviews to do, I know, but important news broken by the BBC today that there was a 2-day wait before NHS managers, doctors, we're not clear, raised the alarm about that meningitis outbreak in Kent. Not good enough, is it?
No, and I can reassure you about 2 things. I mean, in that case, the individual presented on the Wednesday evening unwell. By mid-morning on Thursday, the trust suspected meningitis. They had 24 hours to notify the UK Health Security Agency. They took 26 hours. I can tell you that that delay did not have a material impact in terms of containing the disease, but it is also not good enough, and we have that 24 hours for a reason. There was rapid improvement in terms of the protocols and the trust adhering to them at the time, but there will still be a further accountability conversation for the trust to have with the UK Health Security Agency and with me.
Wes Streeting.
Thank you, Nick.
Health and Social Care Secretary for England, thank you for joining us.
It's just coming round to 8:30. Let's check the sport with Mike. Hello.
Hello again, Anna. As we've been saying, there will be further reflections on the big football news this morning. Mo Salah's departure from Liverpool on the way before 9:00. You can also read much more on the BBC Sport website. And just to mark your card as well, this time tomorrow, Delith will be speaking to the managers of both Wales and Northern Ireland. Craig Bellamy and Michael O'Neill will be with us to look ahead to their crucial World Cup playoff semi-finals tomorrow evening. Northern Ireland taking on Italy, Wales facing Bosnia. So both managers with us tomorrow. Let's now, though, get more on the big news announced late yesterday that the snooker is staying in Sheffield. After years of speculation, the sports world championship will remain at the famous Crucible Theatre until 2045. The 1987 world champion, Dennis Taylor, is delighted.
Everybody that turned professional at football, they want to play at Wembley. And it's the same thing. Everybody that turned pro at snooker, they want to win the World Championship and they want to win it in the Crucible Theatre. And there we are. We're going to have some wonderful champions for many, many years to come in this iconic venue.
Well, as part of the new deal, the Crucible is set to be redeveloped to add up to 500 additional seats. We can talk now to the man who helped broker this deal to keep the World Championships in Sheffield. Delighted to say the president of Matchroom Sport, Barry Hearn, is with us live on the programme. Morning, Barry.
Good morning.
So the World Championships first staged at the Crucible 1977, I think, and what has now been agreed is not a 3-year, 5-year extension, not even a 10-year deal, is it? It's an almost 20-year deal with an option as well for a further 5 years up to 2050. I mean, this is proper long-term security for the sport.
Well, you try and plan things a little bit, don't you? But it's nice to have some good news for a change on the radio in the morning. And I'm so happy, you know, that my personal life changed in the Crucible when Steve Davis won the world title in 81. That's kick-started Matrim as a company. And I'm just so happy that we've got the right deal worked out in very timely fashion. Sheffield City Council were very, very passionate about this, as were my own people. And they ended up, I think, coming to it, what was a fair, you know, fairly negotiated settlement. And once you're with the right partner, you know, we've had a long engagement. I think it was time to get married for life, wasn't it? So, as you say, it's a huge extension of time, but it's because it's where we want to be. And as Dennis said earlier, you know, kids that start playing and watch it on BBC television and, you know, the very few sports these days on BBC, free-to-air, regular sports, the snooker's in a good place and the Crucible is its rightful home.
You did talk very openly, though, Barry, including on this programme this time last year, about the possibility of the championships moving abroad to either China or Saudi Arabia. I just wondered, did the current conflict in the Middle East make you think twice about moving snooker's biggest tournament there?
Really, no. I mean, there were things that we never wanted to leave. Why would we? It's been a fabulous home for us, an iconic venue. But we had to get the right deal, or at least we had to get the work to the Crucible that we wanted. And I honestly didn't think that the Sheffield City Council would be able to come up with that money, you know, because it's a lot of money. But with government backing, I have to say, give credit where it's due, is the money came in, and that's the Crucible will now become an absolute iconic venue. It's not perfect in terms of numbers. I'd love more, but I've got 500 extra per session. There's an awful lot of sessions in snooker over 17 days. And more importantly is it's going to be a world-class venue. It wasn't fit for purpose as the game has got better. Mm. You know, the actual atmosphere for the players to play in is fantastic, but it needed to be a bit bigger. It needed to have better backstage facilities and for hospitality, et cetera, as we all have to grow and be better in what we do every day. They came up with the money, and obviously that was enough for me to say, right, well, we can actually cement, instead of going around talking to people, we can fix our home. You know, I couldn't be happier. And I know 90% of the players are delighted.
You mentioned the money. We should give the figures. The mixture of local and national government committing £35 million to this redevelopment, another £10 million coming from private investment. Cynics might say, Barry, this is a classic bit of Hearn brinkmanship. You talked very openly that the World Championships would leave, could leave Sheffield, threatened that, you know, the UK might lose one of its blue ribbon sporting events, and in the end you've got what you wanted. You've got your 45 million quid and it's staying here for 20 years.
You're probably right, but at the end of the day, it's also a classic bit of telling the truth that the Crucible wasn't fit for purpose. It needed to change. We got stuck in complacency, saying only it's okay, leave it as it is. That's not good enough for us. We set very high standards, and I'm glad to say Sheffield Council, with government and local backing, came up with the goods. And we all got what we wanted. So, as Rockefeller once said, every good deal ends with everybody having a bit of bread in their mouth.
Well, we look forward to enjoying that bread and indeed the World Snooker Championships for the next 20 plus years at its spiritual home, the Crucible Theatre up in Sheffield. World Championships, of course, getting underway next month. Barry Hearn, boss of Matchroom Sport and the key man who brokered that deal to keep the snooker in Sheffield. Many thanks for your time.
Barry Hearn could get the call from Donald Trump, couldn't he? Could be rather useful in those negotiations, you would have thought. Now, in half an hour, Matthew Side talks talent in Sideways.
Something you might not know about me is that when I was 10, I became the top table tennis player for my age group in the country. And you know what? It was great. But there seemed to be a sense of responsibility. My parents had invested in me. My coach had invested in me. The expectations were super high. You see this with talented musicians or artists or software coders or whatever. And it raises a question. Do we own our talents or do they own us? Join me for Sideways this morning at 9 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
The weather today is a bit of a mix, depending on where you are across the UK. Some sunny breaks, patchy cloud and showers around, but during the afternoon there'll be some heavy and thundery showers and even a bit of early snow in the northern hills.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster in Salford, Nick Robinson in London at 24 minutes to 9. Caroline Nichols has a summary of the news.
President Trump has insisted that Iran badly wants a deal to end the four-week conflict. He hinted at a very significant prize given to the US by Iranian negotiators. Tehran has denied that talks are taking place. The head of the world's biggest asset management company has warned the future of the world economy depends on whether Iran continues to threaten the security of shipping. Larry Fink, who runs the American firm BlackRock, told the BBC that if oil prices reached $150 a barrel, it could trigger a global recession. The health secretary, Wes Streeting, told this programme that the situation in Iran had made the economic situation more difficult, but the chancellor was better able to confront the challenge because of the choices she'd made. Counter-terrorism police investigating an arson attack on ambulances run by the Jewish community in Golders Green in London have arrested two men. The men, aged 47 and 45, were held this morning in northwest and central London on suspicion of arson with intent to endanger life. The BBC has learnt that East Kent Hospital's NHS Trust waited 2 days before raising the alarm about the first case of meningitis. Doctors have a legal duty to report cases of the disease to the UK Health Security Agency as soon as they're suspected. The Health Secretary told us the delay didn't have a material impact on containing the disease, but it wasn't good enough.
Caroline, thank you. 23 minutes to nine now. Let's get a little more on those arrests over Monday morning's arson attack on ambulances belonging to a Jewish community trust in Golders Green in North London. Our special correspondent Lucy Manning is with us. Lucy, what more do we know?
Well, in the last 10 minutes, the Metropolitan Police announced that two arrests had been made in relation to this attack. Two men, aged 47 and 45, arrested early this morning, were told at addresses in northwest London and central London. They're arrested on suspicion of arson with intent to endanger life, and they're currently being held in custody. The Met Police, the head of counter-terrorism policing in London, is saying that this is obviously an important break through in the investigation, but they're pointing out that the CCTV, which many people saw of the attack, showed three men running away. Well, probably three men. And the Met are pointing out that they have two men in custody, and that means there is probably another suspect still out there. So the Met is very clear that this investigation is still live, and they will continue to try and identify all those who have been involved. They thank the public and the local Jewish community and say that they appreciate that it is still a worrying time for the Jewish community, who feel vulnerable after these attacks in the heart of the community. But this is a significant breakthrough in their investigation so far.
Thank you. As Lucy Manning.
Time now is 21 minutes to nine. If you've been listening since we came on air, you might have heard the odd mention by me, as well as in the news bulletins, of the interview Simon Jack, our business editor, has got with Larry Fink. Well, Simon joins us in the studio. We are at last going to hear that interview, Simon. For those who might just be raising an eyebrow and thinking, why do we care about the warning of a man who runs a company called BlackRock? Mm. Why should we?
Well, I'll give you a number. $14 trillion. Trillion is how much money BlackRock has under management on behalf of savers around the world. If you look down all the biggest companies in the world, the publicly traded one, and look at their shareholders, almost invariably, the biggest is BlackRock. And now every year, Larry Fink, the boss, sends a letter to the chief executives of the thousands of companies that they invest in and tells them what is on his mind. And what this year, he said, for an arch capitalist, he says capitalism isn't working. It isn't working for workers because the returns on capital, on owning shares, dwarfs the returns on labour. And that's for a workforce which are very unprepared for AI, which will make this inequality worse. We should be sending fewer people to university. But in a rare broadcast interview, he started by laying out a pretty stark couple of binary outcomes for the conflict in Gulf, either oil becomes plentiful and cheap and Iranian, unsanctioned Iranian oil flows freely from the Gulf along with everything else, or it doesn't, with some pretty stark consequences. This is Larry Fink.
I could see a year from now oil at $40 a barrel, or I could see it above $150 a barrel. Well, we have two very extreme outcomes. And in my conversations throughout the world with the U.S. government, all that, to me, everybody has to recognize there's not going to be an outcome that's somewhere in the middle. It's going to either be two extremes. Is Iran a country that can be accepted by the international community? Can Iran be a country that participates in the world again? And if that outcome occurred, then you could have the Iranian oil back into the marketplace alongside the growth of the Venezuelan oil. And you could paint a picture where oil prices could be lower than they were prior to the Iranian war. If there's a cessation of war and yet Iran remains a threat to trade, a threat to the Straits of Hormuz, then I would argue that we could have years of, you know, above $100, closer to $150 oil.
What happens to the global economy if that happens? How do we see it?
We'll have global recession.
The US is essentially energy independent. Should countries, other countries, including the UK, maximize their energy resources, including their oil and gas reserves?
You need to use what you have to provide more abundance in your country. In the UK, you have some solar, you have some wind, you do have hydrocarbons. To me, it is about being pragmatic.
But on oil and gas, use what you've got is the message.
Use what you have, unquestionably, but also aggressively move towards alternative sources too.
It all feels a bit 2007, surging energy prices. We're seeing some cracks in the financial system, particularly in private credit. Mm-hmm. Are those little tremors, you know, before an earthquake? Does this feel very 2007 to you?
I don't see any similarities at all. Zero. 2007 was based on hidden leverage, just gigantic leverage balance sheets. This is not a leverage balance sheet problem. And it was the leverage that was the foundation of the fall of 2008.
We've seen trillions of dollars pumped into AI. When Jimmy Dimon did an interview with the BBC recently, he said a lot of that money might end up wasted. Are we in a bubble? Will a lot of that money be wasted? What do you make of that?
I do not believe we have a bubble at all. That being said, could we have one or two failures in AI? Sure. I'm fine with that. Okay, that's market mechanisms. I believe there's a race for technology dominance. I believe if we do not invest more, China wins. What they're doing is breathtaking in terms of how they're planning out for this, the need for more power. And what I see in Europe is just, you know, I just see a lot of talk and no action.
You also say capitalism isn't working for some people.
True.
And that AI, it seems to me, and you acknowledge this in your letter, has the potential to put inequality on steroids.
AI is going to create an enormous amount of jobs. Most people are not focusing on the part of the letter that I wrote about how many jobs is going to be creating related to electricians and welders and plumbers.
So we should be telling our kids to be electricians rather than lawyers or fund managers.
If you think about how the average worker has been portrayed on television, generally, the average plumber had their overalls or their pants, you know, hanging below their waistline, overweight. We need to embrace that those type of jobs are just as good for many people. Post-World War II, we built a foundation of education, and we said to all the young people, go to college, go to college, go to college. And we probably overdid it.
Larry Fink there, the boss of BlackRock, in reflective mode, Simon, and we can hear a lot more of that.
Yeah, if you go to the Big Boss interview on BBC Sounds, you can listen to a whole 30 minutes of it. And actually, I would say this, but I really do believe it's worth a listen.
Simon Jett, thank you.
It is a 8:45 now. So as the debate about how to limit mobile phone use here in the UK among children continues to go on, so many different competing views on it. Well, the Dutch are examining what can be learned from their ban on mobiles, smartwatches and tablets in the classroom, which has been in place since January of 2024. And when the Dutch government studied more than 300 schools, they found that 3/4 of pupils reported better concentration. Around 2/3 of them said there was a better social atmosphere after phones were taken out of the school day. So our correspondent Anna Holligan has been to one secondary school in Amsterdam to see how those rules are working in practice, but also to ask what lessons there might be for us.
I've just arrived at the Cygnus Gymnasium, and there is a bright fluorescent yellow notice. So from this point, as I cross over into the school playground, pupils' phones have to be stored in their lockers.
Your telephone thuis of in the kluis? So a phone is either at home or in the locker.
That slogan now applies nationwide. Instead of passing a law, the Dutch government went for a national agreement with schools, parents and teachers, arguing it would get everyone on side and bring in the rules quickly.
My name is Henna.
And my name is Fenna.
I think it's annoying, but not like it's violating our rights or something like that.
Yeah, maybe now we are a little bit more in the moment. In the breaks, nobody's on their phones.
Smartphones aren't meant to be out in classrooms in the UK either. But with no national rules on where they should be the rest of the day, schools and teachers are left to improvise. In the Netherlands, the national agreement takes the onus off individual staff, like Miss Peters, which means
there's less friction between teacher and student in class management. Having a more relaxed atmosphere, I think that definitely improves school results, right? When you relax, you're more open to learn. Yeah, you're not too worried about anything else going on.
I'm Felix, and I'm 15 years old.
I'm Carol, and I'm also 15 years old.
Yeah, I've seen some changes. People in like the breaks, they talk more. They're doing stuff like going to the store together and not just sitting on the bench in the cafeteria, sitting on their phone. You socialize more.
The social connections of me and my friends have improved because of less using of our phone.
But the debate has now moved beyond the school gates. The Dutch government advises under 15s to stay off social media. And the new coalition wants an enforceable Europe-wide age limit, arguing addictive platforms deserve the same restrictions as alcohol or gambling.
Just parked my bike by the edge of a canal and I'm heading into the Dutch Ministry of Education.
My name is Koen Becking. There is growing evidence that mobile phones in class harm concentration and learning outcomes. There's growing evidence, of course, that using these phones is bad for your mental health, is bad for your social interaction.
What is the thinking around restricting access to social media?
So kids are distracted, kids feel anxious, not only in schools, but everywhere else in society, I think. We have a lot of data for this. It's not just we think this or we believe this. This is all Dutch data.
And public opinion's shifting in that direction too, with Generation Z, perhaps surprisingly, among the strongest supporters of a ban. Back at Cygnus Gymnasium, I ask Felix and Carol, what would you say to your peers, so 15-year-old boys and girls in the UK, about how your life has changed as a result of the ban?
When I first heard the news, I also thought, like, I want to switch schools. This isn't what I came here for. But I haven't really felt a downside of it.
Both boys spend between 2 and 5 hours a day scrolling. And would you be as positive about the ban that they're talking about for social media for 15-year-olds?
I think you would get used to it, yeah, relatively fast, because that's then the new normal. It wouldn't always be I'm on my phone and then you would just find other things to do.
The Dutch Research Council's now investigating one of the ban's possible unintended consequences, whether going without a phone all day triggers more intense scrolling before and after school. The pupils here in Amsterdam insist it doesn't. But the most rigorous study to date, published in The Lancet last year, found teenagers in phone-free schools compensated for lost screen time almost minute for minute once they got home.
Anna Holligan reporting there from the Netherlands. It is now 10 to 9. The story of an extraordinary life of an exiled Punjabi princess, embraced by the British Royal Court, is to be told in a new exhibition. It's called The Last Princesses of Punjab. It opens at Kensington Palace tomorrow. And the exhibition historian, Dr. Mishka Sinha, joins us in the Today studio. Morning to you.
Good morning.
There's more than one princess told, but there's particular interest in this story of Princess Sophia Duleep Singh. Why so?
Sophia Duleep Singh was an incredible woman. She was a Punjabi princess of South Asian, Ethiopian and German heritage, brought up in Britain, and a very British, English woman in many ways. She was an aristocrat, a socialite, but also a suffragette and a very strong supporter of Indian soldiers when they came here, and she nursed them as well. So a very multidimensional woman.
Well, one thing stands out for me hearing about her for the first time. A suffragette, a goddaughter of Queen Victoria, who fought for the right of women to vote. Quite a character.
Very much so. So she was very strong in her protests against taxation, for example, or having to fill her name in a census. She said, you know, if I'm not a person for the purposes of representation, how can I be a person for the purposes of taxation? She was also a very strong supporter of the right to have dogs without having to pay taxes for them.
So she liked to cause a bit of trouble. She's the daughter of the last Sikh Maharaja.
She was indeed.
Yeah.
And as you can imagine, there was a lot of consternation and concern around the fact that Queen Victoria's goddaughter was doing some quite publicly, you know, at the time considered things that an agitator would do.
She's the focus of the exhibition.
She is indeed the focus of
the princesses. What can we see if we were to go to Kensington Palace?
What you would see is Sophia contextualised amongst all the women who shaped her. And there are some very strong women in her family. So although her father, Maharaja Duleep Singh, is the reason why she was a princess and the reason why she was connected with Queen Victoria, because Queen Victoria, having been and being the head of an empire that had taken Duleep Singh's kingdom, was also a protector to the family. And so that's why we know of her. But we believe she was who she was because of these women. And so that's what you will see when you go into the exhibition. The first woman you'll see was her fierce grandmother, Maharani Jind Kaur, who fought the British.
And the exhibition is opening during Women's History Month.
That's absolutely right.
Because you think she speaks not just to British Sikhs, for whom she must be an important figure.
Absolutely.
But more generally.
That's right. She doesn't speak just to British Sikhs. She stands for a kind of resilience at a time when you needed to be resilient to be able to do the things she did. So on the one hand, she had great privilege because of who she was and because of her acceptance by the royal court. On the other hand, because of that, the public eye was on her all the time, and she knew that the things she did would be seen.
Dr. Mishka Sinha, thank you so much for coming in. The exhibition, The Last Princesses of Punjab, opens at Kensington Palace tomorrow and is on for many months, isn't it?
That's true, until November.
Until November, so lots of opportunity to go. Thank you.
Thank you.
Something else to look forward to this morning from 9 on Radio 3 Unwind. Dr. Sian Williams is delighting in watching the rain while you're out to take a breath. And some beautiful music as well from Nan Avant, Felix Mendelssohn and Scarlatti. If you haven't found Radio 3 Unwind just yet, it is very easy. It's on your digital radio next to Radio 3, or you can search Unwind on BBC Sounds.
Well, let us turn to the news that rocks Liverpool, rock Liverpool fans, and robs the Premier League of one of the greats. The back page headlines include phrases like cheerio to Mo and Mo to go. Yes, we knew it was coming, but Mo Salah is to leave Liverpool, is to leave the Premier League, and is surely headed to play football in Saudi Arabia. Just in case you don't share the obsession with football of some of us, here's a reminder of Mo Salah, one of the great goals against Galatasaray, his 50th UEFA Champions League goal.
Here is Salah. Salah into the area. Wirtz links up well. Back towards Salah. Curling effort. Oh, what a goal. What a splendid goal from Mo Salah. And what a way to bring up a landmark. Been an Egyptian king in the Champions League. That is his 50th goal in the Champions League. And you have to say, that was spectacular.
I wonder how many times the word spectacular has been used to describe a goal by the Egyptian king. Well, a man who knows joins us now, Henry Winter, the sports journalist, alongside Sue Johnson, actress and Liverpool fan. Should I say commiserations to you this morning, Sue?
Yes, certain sadness, certainly. It's always sad to see a great player go, and he has been one of the greatest up there with them, with Kenny and Stevie and a few others. But he really earned his place as king.
Yeah, and it's no small thing to observe that alongside names like Kenny and Stevie, for someone called Mo Salah, for someone who's Egyptian, for someone who's open about his faith, that was no mean achievement.
Absolutely not. And particularly at the time when he came in and politically, you know, it wasn't easy to be a Muslim in this country. And I think, there was a chant about us being Muslims, if he was, and I can't quite remember it, but he brought that to him. I mean, the memories of him coming out and kissing the ground and praying, and he did it with such ease, and so it was fine. You know, I just think it was all part of him, and we accepted it as part of him. And he brought a love of that religion to our city.
Henry, it is easy often to focus on the bad things that football fans say and sometimes do as well. But we forget, don't we, how a player can transform the culture sometimes.
He can transform a culture. He can transform a club. I mean, he is a great player. Sue's been outlining up with Kenny Dalglish and Steven Gerrard, and also from the Premier League perspective, probably up with Thierry Henry as one of the greats we've seen over the last 30 years. But also he, as you say, I mean, he's a beacon for the community, for his faith, for the city, for the Northwest, for the country, and he'll be hugely missed. I mean, when you talk about his goal celebration, and there were 255 of them in 435 games, which is astonishing in itself. Part of his goal celebration was a Muslim prayer. So absolutely, an absolute role model for his faith.
And there'll be statues to him, I suspect, Henry.
Oh, absolutely. And I imagine it'll be a statue of him scoring a goal. So many goals, whether it's in Champions League finals to win Premier Leagues. But the most important thing is the emotional memories that he leaves, as well as, the entrance is in the record books.
Now, I've got to ask you a question which is a little uncomfortable. Did he leave it too late, Sue? Should he have gone before people said Mo's gone off the boil?
No, because he came back and scored that wonderful goal against Galatasaray last week. And you go, well done, Mo. It's a great way to finish. I think it's perfect timing in a way. I would have hated, I don't think the fans would have ever forgotten what he'd given to the club. Liverpool fans aren't like that. He would always be adored but if he'd left it any longer, there was a danger. I don't know how they do it. I feel so sorry for footballers because they can't go on forever like some old actresses we know.
Henry, was this the right time?
Perfect timing. Absolutely. He needed to go. And the great thing is that Sue and the great sort of Anfield choirs and support will be able to serenade him on this wonderful farewell tour over the next 2 months. He is still the reigning footballer of the year. He's still a talent.
What will you chant for him, Sue?
Sorry?
Well, what,